You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Shahid Buttar, who is running for Congress against Nancy Pelosi, wishing him very well in that. Of course, the website you need to check out is shahidforchange.us, S-H-A-H-I-D, for F-O-R, change.us. Shahid, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Thanks for coming on. It's been a long time since I've seen you. I'm familiar with lots of great work, advocacy work and artistic work that you've done for progressive campaigns, issue campaigns. Now you're this is the first time, as far as I know, that you're running for public office. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, this is really I've long worked on different issue campaigns, the peace movement, the anti-globalization movement, the immigrant rights movement, the movement for digital civil liberties, and the right to privacy in the face of the mass surveillance regime. I've worked on LGBT rights, and having done a lot of that issue-based activism over the course of the last 15 years, watching America's most progressive city be represented by someone who ultimately has enabled the Trump administration's war on the Constitution was just too much for me to bear, and I couldn't do it from the sidelines. So throwing my hat into the electoral arena for the first time.
Not to mention the Obama administration and the George W. Bush administration and on back, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the continuity across the bipartisan corporate establishment is really the theme that pervades our campaign platform. You know, I'm concerned about the corporate co-optation of healthcare policy, of military policy, of drug policy, of campaign finance, and of all of these issues. You know, the central challenge confronting our nation today is the control by corporations over our public policy, and that just has to stop. Democrats have not been particularly assertive in offering Americans an alternative. And that's what I'm running to do, is to offer an alternative to corporate bipartisan corporate corruption in Washington.
This seems like it ought to be the model in a representative government. Somebody spends years becoming a leader and an expert on different issues, working as an advocate on issues, and then runs for office, as opposed to, you know, goes to law school, promises wealthy people they'll do whatever they're told, and then runs for office. I mean, that seems like the wrong approach. But you're running in an open primary, right? And so it's not really a question of a party primary. It's whoever are the first two out of all the candidates.
That's exactly right. California has an interesting model for House elections. It's an open primary and a jungle primary, meaning that whereas in a lot of places, each party nominates its candidate, and the candidate from each party that takes first goes to the general election. Here in San Francisco, the way it works is we've got all the different candidates from all the different parties are facing off against each other, and the top two candidates from all the different parties will be the ones in the general election in November. So what that means is that while running to Pelosi's left, because her voting record has been so devoid of principle, I have also the opportunity to run to her right and to mobilize support across the partisan continuum for our campaign. And just to spell that out, while I'm running to Pelosi's left on issues like climate change, on issues like spending priorities in the face of the military-industrial complex, my platform plank that would, for instance, seek a warrant requirement for domestic NSA, FBI, and DEA searches could plausibly be read as a conservative position to conserve our civil liberties in the face of a radical erosion of them that the bipartisan corporate establishment has facilitated. Similarly, my line on drug policy, which aims to not only decriminalize but fully legalize cannabis at the federal level as a civil rights imperative, also could be read as a conservative position to the extent it's liberty enhanced. And I do think that platform, which eschews some of the traditional partisan divisions and really front loads the interests of working Americans across our different communities, across our different political stripes. I have some hope that despite the stranglehold on our democracy by the corporate parties, that I might have an opportunity to bring some new voters to the polls and shake things up a little bit here in San Francisco.
In the issue of military and war and peace is, of course, one that I care a lot about, and I've not seen a Republican candidate for Congress with a website in the past couple of years that didn't sort of celebrate hatred of foreigners and immigrants and cheer for more wars, and I've not seen a Democratic candidate for Congress with a website that's even mentioned the existence of the other 96% of humanity, foreign policy, military spending. I mean, just not mentioned, doesn't exist, right? 60% of right. what they're going to vote on, but doesn't exist. And so to go to your website, shahidforchange.us, and you say, not only admit that military spending exists, but say you want to cut it, which agrees with public opinion polls, you know, the majority of people in the United States, not just San Francisco, want to cut it. But then, of course, my question is, how much do you want to cut it?
Great question. I want to cut it as much as we need to secure social services. I take a lot of inspiration here from President Eisenhower and the fact that the Supreme Allied Commander of the victorious forces in World War II, two-term U.S. president, saw fit to dedicate his last address to the American people in office as a very dire warning that democracy in the United States would be threatened by the combination of profit-seeking enterprises serving military interests, was incredibly important historically, and it's incredibly important now because Eisenhower's warning explained not only the co-optation of our federal budget and our taxpayer dollars by the military-industrial complex, but also the constitutional crisis and the war on your and my and all of your listeners' rights by agencies including the NSA and the FBI. Warrantless surveillance is an incredibly expensive, profit-laden enterprise, just like corporate weapons manufacturing.
Yeah.
There are a couple places where I think the military budget especially needs to be addressed. The very first program that I would like to take an axe to is the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, which is a quintessential example of fraud, of waste, of procurement malpractice, to quote a Navy procurement official. And this is a program that has no strategic rationale, will cost $1 trillion with a T and a half dollars over the life cycle of the program. And I think it's really hard for people to envision what $1 trillion means. But if we cut the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, we could have Medicare for all in this country. We could have a substantial increase in HUD block grants to address the affordable housing crisis in urban centers around the country. $1.5 trillion will take you a long way. And I want to particularly make two points here, if I may. One, a lot of Americans, particularly Republicans, but I think others too, might be inclined to, for instance, argue that we should support our troops. And I wanted to just make clear that the military does not spend our taxpayer dollars on supporting our troops. There are 10% of the Americans that are homeless around the country are military veterans, and the money that our taxpayer dollars go to the Pentagon but are fundamentally misappropriated. And if we support our troops, we should be supporting expansions in VA benefits to get every veteran a roof over their head, which we could do if we cancel fraudulent and failed corporate weapons contracts like the one undergirding the F-35. You know, our nation has a greater interest in housing veterans than we do in sending the children of Lockheed Martin executives to fancy ski vacations. And then just the other point I'd want to make here is that programs like the F-35, high-tech, fancy corporate weapon systems, lack a strategic rationale of any kind, because we know at the moment that the greatest threat to U.S. national security, greatest threat, I'll name three, to U.S. national security are climate change, which the Pentagon has recognized, culture and election hacking, which is very much the object of emphasis in Washington at the moment, and our criminally kleptocratic president, who, you know, at various points has been essentially goading different powers into unnecessary conflicts. You can't fight any of those things with a fighter. So, you know, we're wasting $1.5 trillion on a program that has no rationale, is an object of fraud, and we have vital social needs that need to be addressed. And in my mind, that is the central issue confronting our country, is securing social services by battling the military-industrial complex. And that's an interest that cuts across party and across the country.
Well, I couldn't possibly agree more. Very well said. Dramatically different and better answer than I could get out of Nancy Pelosi if she would come on my program. But still not any more of an answer than I would get out of her in terms of how much you would cut the military budget. Right? I mean, if you were to introduce a bill to reduce put a cap on the military spending, how much would you reduce it by?
You know, at the moment, we're spending something on the order of $600 billion a year on military purposes. But rather than set a cap on the military budget, I'd like to identify particular line items like the F-35, for instance, like U.S. military bases in foreign countries.
Yeah.
Closing U.S. military bases in foreign countries could save up to $200 billion a year. And that not only would secure, release funds available then to fund social services, but it would also have a very dramatic impact on our climate emissions. The particular amount that the F-35 savings would be per year, we haven't yet researched, but $1.5 trillion over the life cycle of the program, I think, is significant. Again, I haven't set a firm cap on what I would support for the military, but I am very interested in carving out line items to recover those funds for more pressing needs.
Okay. Well, that's a good answer, although I would say that it's not 600 for the Pentagon. It's $700 billion now and rising fast each year, not counting a couple hundred billion more for nukes in the Energy Department and militarism in the State Department and the Homeland Security Department and on, and debt for past wars and veterans costs. It's twice what they tell us it is. But just before we go on to lots of other topics, among the line items that I would have hoped to see on your website would have been some of the wars. Are there any wars you would end?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I think there's never been a military fund request that the incumbent does not support it. And, you know, I've been opposed to war generally my entire life. You know, I've been arrested trying to stop the war in Iraq. I've been outspoken about stopping new wars. I do certainly think that we need to consider, in the same way that the F-35 will cost $1.5 trillion over its life cycle, we need to consider the life cycle costs of war, which are far greater than what policymakers are generally willing to accept. You know, and that includes the cost of veterans coming home with shattered minds and shattered lives. It includes the epidemic of suicides that are plaguing military families among people who return from conflict. It also includes the carbon emission of a Pentagon that is run amok around the country. And it particularly includes the deaths of innocents from other countries that our wars inevitably leave in their wake. And I think that there are particular problems with all of our interventions. And there are different problems in each of those interventions. And I would like to see them end. As a member of Congress, you know, we don't have the authority to necessarily order the military, but we do have authority in our oversight capacity and as legislators to ask the questions that aren't being asked and to make funding decisions. I've actually been arrested in a Senate hearing chamber for asking a question that no member of Congress has ever had the independence to raise, particularly about the crisis in the rule of law illustrated by the NSA mass surveillance regime. But with respect to our wars, I really would like to pose some questions of executive officials under oath about the strategic rationale. In Afghanistan, we've been at war for over a decade, and there is no clear road to victory in sight. And the idea that that conflict has a military resolution defies every piece of evidence to the contrary. It would seem from our foreign policy and our military policy as if the United States learned nothing from Vietnam. And those are lessons that I would seek to make very clear, both in the oversight context and in the legislative one. I certainly would not be voting for increases for particular conflicts in the military budget, and I would be looking for, again, line items to defund in the military. As a legislator eager to end war, that's about the most one can do, but I'm very eager to do everything within my capacity, and as I have been for, as an individual, that I would like to be able to do as an office holder to bring an end to these conflicts. Yeah. And quite frankly, save some lives.
Well, there are limits to what one Congress member can do. He or she has to organize their colleagues, right? But under the War Powers Resolution, my former employer for a short time, Dennis Kucinich, used to almost routinely introduce resolutions to force votes in the House on whether to end a war. And as you know, in the Senate, they are now undertaking that process for the first time in U.S. history, forcing a vote in the Senate on whether to end the war on Yemen. I mean, if Congress says thou shalt not spend a dime on such and such war, that ends that war under the U.S. Constitution. I mean, Congress is not constitutionally, Congress's role is not just to sort of be a bunch of people who ask questions, right? I mean, Congress is actually the decider on these things according to the Constitution, right?
Of course. No, and the War Powers Act and the responsibility of Congress to make decisions about whether or not to declare war is a crucial zone for Congress and members of Congress to defend in the face of a litany of presidents who have essentially undermined it by waging war essentially unilaterally without congressional approval. You know, the last president to try this unsuccessfully was President Obama, who tried to initiate a war in Syria without congressional approval, and thankfully that stopped. The war in Yemen is an ongoing humanitarian travesty. And I do think absolutely that our not just military, this is where I would maybe suggest some subtleties. We do need to have accountability. I think that the accountability for some of these conflicts lies not only within the Defense Department and the military, but also in our civilian leadership, which is why I also favor seeking the impeachment of the president and the vice president. You know, we need to have sane leadership at the top. And I have a great deal of empathy for military service members who might have essentially been conscripted in a poverty draft, you know, seeking educational opportunity, who are then sent off to some foreign theater in an unnecessary conflict and are put in, you know, untenable positions. And the people with whom the responsibility for those decisions lie, they're outside the military apparatus. So I absolutely would be a force in Congress to organize among my colleagues. I'd be seeking creative opportunities to put these questions before the House, and I think it's particularly important. The reason I raise oversight, you're absolutely right that members of Congress are not supposed to be merely question askers, but the legislative hearings provide opportunities for visibility about concerns that otherwise might, for instance, escape the press, and many of the issues that we're talking about, for better or worse, were entirely predictable. It's not like no one guessed that the war in Iraq would be a debacle. We all knew that. We were saying it for months before the invasion. And, you know, yet still the people who have made such predictably bad decisions in the civil service remain in place. You know, obviously there's been a lot of turnover in the civilian leadership of the executive branch since then. But we need very much to examine these questions closely in public. And I think one of the biggest issues there is to seek transparency in the face of otherwise essentially secret decision making. And transparency through the oversight process, I think, could go a long way towards helping galvanize the consensus across Congress to make, for instance, more assertive funding decisions, to make more assertive policy decisions. I think the oversight process is one key to that broader project.
Yeah, we are speaking with Shahid Buttar. The website is shahidforchange.us. I was very glad to hear you bring up impeachment because I was, of course, going to ask you about that. And this is my biggest concern with Nancy Pelosi is that she is such a strong advocate for keeping presidents around, for keeping George W. Bush around,
right,
in order to quote unquote oppose him, for keeping Donald Trump around. I mean, Rahm Emanuel, you may recall in January 07, said, no, we're not going to end the war. Everybody just gave us the majorities in Congress to end. We're going to keep it going so we can oppose it 2 years from now in another election. To my mind, this is Nancy Pelosi's clear and transparent strategy, is to keep Donald Trump in office in order to be the people who are not Donald Trump and not have to be anything better than that, while at the same time focusing all the opposition to Donald Trump around the disastrous policy of Russiagate rather than the endless list of what I see as the top impeachable offenses. Am I being paranoid here, or what do you think her goal is?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, whether it was George W. Bush or whether it's Donald Trump, Nancy Pelosi, unfortunately, is much more willing to speak about resistance than to actually demonstrate it. And, you know, one reason I think the folks who've been excited by my candidacy are excited about it is because they recognize that I have the resistance for me is a way of life. It's not just a hashtag to conveniently rally under. You know, I came out of law school the year that the United States invaded Iraq, and my law school experience included the 9/11 attacks and the Bush versus Gore decision. My entire legal career has been bound up in resistance. And in fact, even my life prior to going to law school at Stanford was bound up in resistance of a different sort. And at the end of the day, I look at the Democratic leadership's appeasement of militaristic presidents as, you know, a threat to the Republic. And it presents particularly a couple interesting flips. For instance, every member of Congress bears an oath of office to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the greatest domestic threats to our Constitution tend to be presidents and executive agents. And when faced with those threats, even despite swearing oaths, members of Congress seem to be, for better or worse, entirely absent. And I do think that's absolutely a problem. Now, with respect to President Trump and Vice President Pence, there are an endless list of impeachable offenses. And while Democrats focus on Russiagate, I think the real question here, in my mind, the Emoluments Clause is the stronger basis on which to seek the impeachment of the president, because it's quite clear, I think, to anyone paying any shred of attention that President Trump's interest in office is much more about self-enrichment than it is about governance.
Yep.
And that is a constitutional crime, full stop. I would also say it's important, if we seek the impeachment of President Trump, to also seek the impeachment of Vice President Pence, because if the vice president becomes the president due to the removal of Trump, there is a danger that we have leaped from a frying pan into the fire. You know, one of the sole saving graces of this administration is that it's incompetent might be enough to keep the American people from its worst. That's no comfort to the rest of the world, for instance, that is doomed, for instance, to rising oceans due to our belligerence on climate, or the people in other countries where our military is continuing grinding offenses that could be ended. You know, it's very important to make sure that impeachment proceedings capture the both figures at the top of the administration. And I think the self-enrichment of the president in particular, provides a compelling, strong ground with respect to his actions. And I think the beneficiary of potential foreign intervention in our election, the beneficiaries of that intervention include not only the president, but the vice president as well.
Well, I'm not with you on the notion that Russia determined the outcome of any election, but I am with you on a doubleheader impeachment for a dozen or more charges that don't involve Russia, but do involve the Constitution. Just to play devil's advocate, though, I think if you were to impeach and remove Trump and have a President Pence facing the legitimate threat of a popularly inspired impeachment and removal should he step out of line, that would be an improvement over a President Trump who clearly flaunts his absolute impunity. And if you take the two of them, the immediate objection is going to be, well, who's third in line? They're not, you know, they're no good either. And then you can go down through the list, and none of them are any good. So, I mean, at some point you have to say, well, this is enough impeachments. The threat of impeachment is going to have to carry us forward, right?
I mean, I do think there's a lot to be said for the threat of impeachment, which is one reason why Nancy Pelosi taking it off the table is so problematic, because executive officials who abuse the public trust and commit constitutional crimes should fear removal from office. That's an absolutely legitimate tactic for Congress to pursue. Quite frankly, it's a necessary one for Congress to pursue, given how deeply corruption threatens the Republic at the moment. I mean, historically, the kinds of corruption I've been concerned about was, you know, the sort of corruption when corporations wield control over our public policy with President Trump in office, the kind of corruption we have to fear is layers worse, particularly because it's like first order self-enrichment corruption. You know, every time the president goes to Mar-a-Lago and brings the Secret Service with him to stay at his hotel, that is self-enrichment.
Sure.
It's basically taking taxpayer dollars and putting it in his pocket. Every time he has a conference and invites foreign dignitaries to do a meeting at one of his hotels, or every time he uses his social media presence to promote official gatherings at one of his properties, you know, this is a perfect example of first order corruption. You know, it's the kind of corruption that it doesn't take a genius to recognize.
Yeah.
And yet still, Nancy Pelosi won't pursue the process that the founders of our country built into the Constitution, anticipating these kinds of possibilities. I think it's absolutely important that we seek impeachment of the president. With respect to the vice president, that might be a place for us to constructively disagree. Again, I think that he should be included in impeachment proceedings. I do fear a President Pence to some extent more than I do a President Trump. I mean, the one thing you could say for Vice President Pence is that he's held office before, and so perhaps he's less a maniac than the president. I fear, though, as a progressive, that a President Pence would be dramatically more effective in advancing his agenda than the fool we have at the top now.
Yeah.
And that's one reason why I particularly would hope to see him encompassed within impeachment proceedings should they move forward, because, again, removing Trump and leaving the vice president in place could be a leap out of a frying pan into a worse situation.
Well, I fear any president in an era without impeachment more than I fear particular personalities. But we've got about a minute left, and I wanted to ask you, in a system that is corrupt, including in its elections, you're running on a campaign that includes reforming elections, but you're trying to win within the current election system. This will be a wonderful test, I think, of whether this can be done, because you're going to be an outstanding candidate. But can it be done?
We will find out, and I certainly hope so. I do think that Americans across our various places and across our political stripes recognize that corruption also includes the erosion of the legitimacy of our political process. And you can see that in campaign finance inequities. You can see that in gerrymandering, the process through which legislators choose who their constituents are instead of letting their constituents choose who we will be.
Yep.
And you also see it in voter suppression and the litany of measures passed by Republican legislators to deny Americans access to the ballot. I'll note that Democrats have been largely unhelpful in defending voting rights, and the novel prescription I would have to address campaign finance inequities, gerrymandering, prison gerrymandering, which is a separate problem that in some respects is even worse, and vote suppression at once, would be to extend federal antitrust statutes to encompass political markets in addition to economic markets. That would give federal judges a broad statutory basis to intervene and guard fairness and competition in the electoral process. I think that prescription.
It's an incredibly creative and wonderful idea, competition in political markets. We should do a whole show on it. I wish we weren't already over time. We've been speaking with Shahid Buttar. ShahidForChange.us is the website. Shahid, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me, David. It's always great to talk with you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media didn't make too much of the 15th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and perhaps it's just as well, as they'd have likely used the occasion to reinforce their favored idea that the spectacularly devastating invasion was due preeminently to popularly shared miscalculations on which they reported, rather than a campaign of demonization and deceit in which they participated. By early 2004, what media still presented as a U.S. campaign to win hearts and minds in Iraq came up against reality hard in the city of Fallujah, where a military attack and siege killed hundreds of Iraqi civilians. Reporting on this first battle of Fallujah was a case study in the gap between corporate media's picture of the war and what we were able to learn from independent reporters. In April 2004, Counterspin spoke with journalist Rahul Mahajan, just returned from Fallujah. We'll hear that interview again today. Also on the show, racial justice groups are suing the Department of Homeland Security to get access to something called the race paper that may provide clues to the surveillance of black activists. Why do we have to fight the state for protection for First Amendment activities? And why don't corporate media care? We'll hear from Omar Farah, staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. The intent of U.S. economic sanctions on Venezuela is clear: to inflict maximum pain on Venezuela so as to encourage the people of the country to overthrow the democratically elected government. But as media studies teacher and author Gregory Shupak wrote recently for FAIR.org, U.S. media coverage of Venezuela's financial crisis has gone out of its way to obscure this. It was little noted when, 2 weeks before the Trump administration intensified sanctions last summer, a U.N. special rapporteur noted that they would worsen the situation of the people of Venezuela. When Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, in November of 2017, proposed a meeting with creditors to discuss a restructuring of the country's public debt, the Trump administration warned U.S. bondholders that even attending the meeting could put them in violation of economic sanctions, which could be punished by 30 years in jail or as much as $10 million in fines. That same month, the U.S. added new sanctions that prevent Venezuela from doing what governments routinely do with much of their debt, which is roll it over by borrowing again when a bond matures. The sanctions made it nearly impossible for Venezuela to undertake debt restructuring. According to economist Mark Weisbrot, the sanctions appear designed to prevent an economic recovery and worsen the shortages, which include essential medicines and food. All of this is rarely mentioned when U.S. media report the hardships facing Venezuelans. A New York Times story a few months back told readers that Venezuelan children are facing hunger, with hundreds dying from malnutrition because, quote, years of economic mismanagement set the stage for the current disaster, close quote. The Washington Post's editorial board, in writing about what it misdescribed as Latin America's worst ever refugee crisis, told readers, quote, though it controls the world's largest oil reserves, the regime founded by Hugo Chavez has wrecked not just oil production, but the economy as a whole, close quote. NBC's website said Venezuela's crisis can be traced back to Chavez and cited years of excessive regulations that have discouraged local production. Nary a whisper of the U.S. role in wrecking the Venezuelan economy as a whole. It's a striking example of what Venezuelan economist Francisco Rodriguez described in Foreign Policy as a, quote, problematic idea driving current U.S. policy, the belief that financial sanctions can hurt the Venezuelan government without causing serious harm to ordinary Venezuelans, close quote. Starving the Venezuelan economy of its foreign currency, Rodriguez wrote, quote, risks turning the country's current humanitarian crisis into a full-blown humanitarian catastrophe, close quote. As with Syria, U.S. coverage of humanitarian disasters that erases the U.S. role serves as advertisement for more of the same policies that contributed to the catastrophe. National Geographic has long had a negative reputation for exoticizing people of color and failing to challenge colonialism and its legacies. The magazine addresses this history in its new issue, and most are crediting them with trying, anyway. Though, as sociologist Victor Ray assesses in a Washington Post op-ed, the magazine rather steps on its message with a cover story on mixed-race twins that traffics in the same sort of curiosity and surprise racial cliches that the magazine claims it's interrogating, along with a lazy social science that presents racism as a matter of individual attitudes and overstates progress toward equality. But only Richard Prince of the online column Journalisms seems to have thought to reach out to Charles Cobb, former field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, a co-founder of the National Association of Black Journalists, and the Geographic's first black staff writer. Cobb noted that no one from the magazine contacted him about the race issue, despite his being not just the first, but until the hiring of a new culture editor last summer, the Geographic's only black staff writer. He confirmed that white supremacist images and words infected the magazine for decades, but he said he found omission an even bigger problem. Quote, the most difficult stories to persuade the magazine to take on were stories about Africa that were not natural science stories, close quote, Cobb said. And he added, stories about black America were the toughest sell of all. Cobb called for a deeper discussion, quote, about how white supremacy has functioned in this country, especially in media, and the depth of the white supremacist sensibility, close quote. For National Geographic and other media, he says, it is a bit too easy to say, we're not like that now. Finally, another co-founder of the National Association of Black Journalists died March 19th. Les Payne was a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, a passionate, or if you're the New York Times, fervid columnist, and a mentoring editor at Long Island Newsday. As the latter paper, where he worked for decades, noted, Les Payne went undercover with migrant farm workers in Long Island. He tracked heroin from Turkey to the United States and covered the guerrilla war in Zimbabwe and the Soweto uprising in South Africa. But readers might remember most how he fiercely challenged the assumptions of his suburban audience at Newsday, demanding they continue to face the racism that continues to plague the country and the press. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In April 2004, CNN brought on the editor-in-chief of Al Jazeera, one of a handful of networks then broadcasting from inside the Iraqi city of Fallujah, then under siege from U.S. forces, and the site, we were hearing, of mounting civilian casualties. Rather than ask if Al Jazeera's footage corroborated such accounts, CNN badgered him about why he didn't suppress the footage. Insisted CNN's Darren Kagan, quote, isn't the story, though, bigger than just the simple numbers? With all due respect to the Iraqi civilians who have lost their lives, the story bigger than just the numbers of people who were killed or the fact that they might have been killed by the U.S. military, that the insurgents, the people trying to cause problems within Fallujah, are mixing in among the civilians, making it actually possible that even more civilians would be killed. That the story is what the Iraqi insurgents are doing,
in addition to what is the response from the U.S. military, close quote. For a different view, you had to look to different independent journalists. Also in April 2004, Counterspin heard from Rahul Mahajan, author of the book Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Mahajan had just returned from Iraq, where he spent some time in besieged Fallujah. Here's Counterspin Steve Rendell talking with Rahul Mahajan in April 2004.
Rahul, let's begin with the overall import of the attack and the siege of Fallujah. How important is this story, do you think?
This is critical. In fact, I wrote at one point that the events of the past few weeks may be seen in the future as just as much of a turning point for the world as the events surrounding 9/11. This is the time, in this past month or 5 weeks, this is the time when any possibility for the United States to build some kind of stable military client regime that is accepted by just enough Iraqis that it can survive pretty much seems to have collapsed, and Iraqi public opinion is crystallizing into from resentment and frustration into anger and resistance.
Do you feel like the U.S. press is giving that sort of import to the story, is seeing the story the same way you are?
No, I don't. In fact, it was hard to always get a clear sense of what was going on in the U.S. media while I was there. But I got the impression that Bob Woodward's latest book trading on his own access to the president was being treated as more important than this critical turning point in the occupation.
Well, there's a late-breaking story as we tape this show on April 29th that an agreement has been reached where Iraqi security forces will go into Fallujah and U.S. forces will withdraw. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is that these are Iraqi security forces under a rehabilitated Ba'athist General Saddam's. They didn't give the full name, but most likely Lieutenant General Salah Abud al-Jaburi, who was the governor of Al-Anbar province, which includes Fallujah and Ramadi. So this is just yet another example of the feeling that Iraqis have and express all the time about the occupation, meet the new boss, same as the old boss.
Why wouldn't they welcome this former friend of Saddam, former colleague of Saddam, this Ba'athist Sunni, Sunni general?
Well, first of all, I would say they probably will welcome him more than they would an American commander of forces there. I mean, the status of the occupation has fallen that low. But the standard story that they give you about Fallujah as a Ba'athist stronghold, a Saddamist stronghold, is simply untrue, and people who knew anything about the politics and history of Iraq would not be able to make this claim. There were Saddamist strongholds like Tikrit and to a lesser degree Samarra, but Fallujah, ever since 1995 when Saddam killed one of the big native sons of Al-Anbar province, Muhammad al-Mazlum al-Dulaymi, there's been almost an open state of blood feud between some of the tribes in Al-Anbar province and those and Saddam's tribe.
Well, on media coverage of Fallujah over the last few weeks, we've seen repeated news reports saying the U.S. is trying to keep down the numbers of civilian casualties inside Fallujah. For instance, in the New York Times on April 27th, Eric Schmidt reports that the U.S. Marine strategy in Fallujah is designed to avoid civilian casualties. What do you say to that?
Well, what I would say is that assaults on residential areas with AC-130 gunships cannot possibly be designed to minimize civilian casualties. Attacks by snipers in which, by the evidence of my own eyes, I saw that people who were hit and wounded or killed were a full cross-section of the population, including women, children, and old people, are hardly designed to limit civilian casualties. The use of 2,000-pound bombs, again, in residential areas. If they wanted to limit civilian casualties, they should have had Marine riflemen go on the ground without all of this bombing from the air. This is just another example of what we've seen so often, especially with Fallujah, which is that the military makes some claim, like Mark Kimmett can say, well, 95% of the people killed are fighting men, and it's simply reported without any attempt at critical questioning or interrogating those claims.
In one of your dispatches on empirenotes.org, you issue an estimate of the number of women and children and the number of civilians that have died inside Fallujah. What did you find?
Well, The numbers I quote in the article on Empire Notes are actually from the director of Fallujah General Hospital, who said over 600 people killed, roughly 200 women, roughly 100 children. I saw myself about 20 casualties come in to one small clinic that was being used as a hospital over the course of several hours. And again, the composition of those casualties are completely consistent with those numbers.
While we've seen some of those numbers in mainstream media accounts, it seems like the mainstream media, with all its resources, has a hard time finding this information. Why is it so easy for you, do you think, and so difficult for them?
Well, in the case of Fallujah, very recently, you know, their excuses is actually legitimate. It's been difficult for Western reporters to get in recently. This doesn't explain why for so many months, when so many reporters have been covering the occupation, there are huge stories that go completely uninvestigated. Like, for example, where is an accounting of the CPA's use of Iraq's oil revenues? No reporters have gone and done that, even though it would have been very easy. In this case, however, very few Western journalists got in, and the problem is rather that there's this this wholesale dismissal of Arab journalists, of reports from eyewitnesses on the ground. There was a slight improvement in this reporting as refugees from Fallujah got to Baghdad, and a handful of reporters have actually interviewed them and reported what they said.
You know, there are many media assumptions in covering this story, and one of them is that day one of the Fallujah story, that the Fallujah story really began on that day when the four U.S. contractors were killed. I believe five Marines were killed that day, too. Is that really day one of this story?
To me, day one of this story is 1 year and 1 day ago, April 28th of 2003. It's before the end of what Bush then called a major combat operations. And there is a protest in Fallujah. Human Rights Watch people who investigated found no reason to believe that the people protesting were armed, even if there were some guns, though they were certainly a peaceful, nonviolent protest. And U.S. soldiers fired into a crowd of a few hundred people, killing 15. A couple days later, they killed again three civilians. And this set off the constant cycle of violence and resistance and increasing resentment and hatred of the people of Fallujah against the soldiers and the occupation. That's when it really started.
Rahul, I want to change directions a little bit here. In today's New York Times, today is April 29th, there's a story about Al Jazeera and about how the coalition has begun to analyze the accuracy of Arab media outlets. They use something they call a truth matrix. What is your thoughts about the recent sort of assault, really, on Arab media, particularly Al Jazeera?
Well, first of all, it really is an assault. I mean, I think it's scandalous that the military has attacked Al Jazeera headquarters so many times, that the military made Al Jazeera's withdrawal from Fallujah, initially tried to make it a condition of the ceasefire, and that the Western media, who you think ought to have some sort of collegial relationship with their fellows in the Arab world, don't say anything about this and don't make a big deal about this extremely blatant, you know, direct violent coercion against the media. So that's one kind of assault. And then there's this other kind of assault. I'd love to see a truth matrix done on Judith Miller's reporting about weapons of mass destruction in the New York Times.
That was Counterspin Steve Rendell talking with reporter Rahul Mahajan in 2004. Listeners know the U.S. government has a shameful history of surveilling and intimidating people engaged in First Amendment-protected acts of public protest or public criticism. Black activists have for decades been victims of campaigns to demonize, harass, and discredit them and their movements. So when racial justice groups, using the Freedom of Information Act to find out how the FBI and Department of Homeland Security are monitoring protests around police violence and the movement for Black Lives, turn up a document referred to as the Race Paper, which on receipt turns out to be completely redacted with not even the official title visible, it makes for a handy emblem, but just an emblem of a problem that's far deeper and more worrying. Joining us now to talk about the Race Paper and what it may tell us is Omar Farah, staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome to Counterspin, Omar Farah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the Center for Constitutional Rights and Color of Change have filed a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security to get at the contents of this memo. Based on the references to it that you could see, what do you suspect they're hiding?
Well, I think you have to start with the function of the agency that produced the report in order to get a sense of what it might say. And as you pointed out, it is entirely redacted. Every version of the document that we have is blacked out from the first word to the very last, and each report is roughly 7 or 8 pages. The sub-agency within the Department of Homeland Security that produced the report and that itself calls it the race paper is the Intelligence and Analysis Office, which is tasked with producing predictive intelligence and national security-related information that then gets funneled throughout the federal government. And so we are left with the unfortunate assumption that at least part of what this is a counter-terror or intelligence-related assessment that somehow implicates the question of race. How that is, we obviously can't say, but the two things together are enough to raise some very disquieting questions.
Let's just unpack a little bit this idea of predictive intelligence. This is this idea where supposedly you have analytical frameworks or algorithms that can predict criminality?
That's one of the most pressing fears that I have in speculating about what might actually be behind these redactions. Some of the emails that accompanied the transmission of the race paper within DHS INA, the Intelligence and Analysis Office, included references to things like drivers and indicators. Now, I have to be perfectly honest, we just don't know what the document says. But those terms to me, in the absence of any other information, suggest ways in which law enforcement and intelligence agencies within the government have in the past tried to use indicators that would help them predict criminality or behavior. Those things, of course, are invariably based on totally bunk analytical frameworks that ascribe behavioral tendencies to certain protected classes of people by race and oftentimes by religion, we've seen in a national security context. Those are things that the public needs to be aware are potential uses of this race paper, and it certainly deserves full scrutiny. Those kinds of frameworks are exactly the things that lead to the most unfortunate kinds of law enforcement tactics. We've seen it in stop and frisk. We've seen it in counterterror-related policing. And it's one of the things that made the documents jump out at us amongst the thousands of documents that we got.
Well, I'm not sure that we should need to say that public protest is protected activity, that every day it's more obviously an activity that we need to vigorously protect. And that calling for things to change, even if that means things, yes, including this police force that's right in front of me as I'm protesting, calling for change is not a crime.
Calling for change is not a crime. It's indispensable to the health of the democracy. But as you know well, historically, black and brown voices for accountability and for change, and particularly around policing, have historically been viewed as deeply threatening. And that is part of the overall context that prompted the Center for Constitutional Rights and Color of Change to initiate this FOIA. It was the very real experience of people in the Movement for Black Lives and allied activists recognizing that by speaking out about the crisis levels of police violence against black people, they were being targeted. And our effort was really to uncover the scope of that targeting and to arm people in the movement with the information they need to resist the chilling effect that has.
You hear people say that, well, if activists don't commit any crimes, then, really there's nothing to worry about. And that seems to miss something fundamental about the way that this happens, about the impact of this kind of surveillance.
I couldn't agree more. That is a framing that reads out of our history all of the ways that law enforcement has expressly targeted political speech to raise the stakes associated with speaking out to a point that just discourages people from doing it. It's not about anyone's individual criminality or lack thereof. It's about what it costs to get into the street and say, enough is enough, this has to change. And if law enforcement uses race or religion or a particular political viewpoint as a proxy for criminality or threat, it just means that many more of us are going to be reluctant to speak out when it's absolutely necessary.
Well, a fully redacted document strikes me as not just bizarre, but as journalistic catnip. But as of now, I've seen write-ups in Gizmodo, The Intercept, Splinter, The Root, Wisconsin Gazette, News One, Blavity, RT, Mint Press, Color Lines. I may have missed one or two. But as of this morning, March 22nd, my search of mainstream media, so-called, found Bupkis on this race paper. Am I missing something, that this is not an important story?
No, I think it's absolutely an important story. You're touching on, I think, one of the sort of equally troubling things that is a feature of the sort of counterterrorism national security paradigm that oftentimes we find ourselves in these days. I mean, one of the bases that the Department of Homeland Security is using to claim their entitlement to black out the entirety of the race paper is the National Security Act. FOIA is a statute that encourages transparency, but it does give the government some exemptions that it can claim if it thinks that something is too sensitive to be released to the public. And one of the ways that the government is using that in this case is to say this information in the race paper implicates the National Security Act. And so unless you are the kind of journalist who sees this as catnip and can't resist asking more probing questions about what's behind it, you're left with just a totally blacked out document. And of course, that presents real challenges for reporting. So it doesn't surprise me that this is a story that hasn't gained national attention just yet. I certainly hope that in the near future, a judge will see it our way and suggest that at least some of that document can be segregated, some information can be disclosed to us, and that ends up being the thing that draws more eyes to this document.
We've been speaking with Omar Farah, staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. You can find their work online at ccrjustice.org. Omar Farah, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
I really appreciate your interest in the story. Thanks a lot.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
If global warming is real, why is this winter so awful in the Northern Hemisphere? If you live in North America, especially the Northwest or the Northeast, this winter seems colder at times, with more snow, more long-lasting, and just plain nasty. What happened to that nice global warming scientists promised? And sure enough, even the short-term weather models predicted an easy, mild winter. Except for a small group of scientists who are not watching for El Niño or La Niña for answers, they are looking at a brand new Arctic that is warming at twice the rate of the rest of the planet. Sea ice is near record low, as we heard in last week's show. And it's thin, and it's easily broken by storms, and there's more of those storms, and snow cover is declining. So it's time for some ugly truth from a pioneer in this field, climatologist Judah Cohen. Are we ready for the awful truth? Maybe in the Northern Hemisphere, winters will be worse and wilder for a while, destabilized by rapid heating in the Arctic, even in winter. In our second interview, a new and unexpected feedback loop could limit the amount of carbon dioxide absorbed by the ocean. Since about 90% of our emissions have been hidden in the ocean so far, and that heating has delayed for a few hundred years, this could be serious news. It's deep science on a way life responds to carbon pollution, and it means a short-term cut to more heating sooner. Can we geoengineer our way out of that? Stay tuned for Dr. Andrew Allen on the new discovery. And welcome to Radio EcoShock. Here we go.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
What the heck happened to those warmer winters we were promised with global warming? Don't ask New Englanders why they're still digging out, or Siberians and Europeans whether this winter will ever end. We've reached one of the few climatologists who predicted this weird bend in climate change. Dr. Judah Cohen is the Director of Seasonal Forecasting at AER, and that stands for the private meteorological company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. Cohen is also a research affiliate at the Parsons Lab at MIT and author of many scientific papers. His latest paper, co-authored with Carl Pfeiffer and Jennifer Francis, was just published March 13th in Nature Communications. The title is Warm Arctic Episodes Linked with Increased Frequency of Extreme Weather in the United States. Judah Cohen, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I don't know whether I called you up to find out why it's so miserable this winter or just to complain.
I tell all my friends, please don't shoot the messenger. Gang of Lies, I'm not the favorite person. I'm not everybody's favorite person these days. So,
well, no, you're telling us the opposite of what we wanted. We're all looking forward to being toasty warm here in the North.
Yeah, no. People want to hear a certain message, and they don't get that message they want to hear. They're not happy. But that's what I'm finding out this winter.
So what's the weather been like where you are lately?
Yeah, we've had this, calling this parade of nor'easters. I've had three so far. You know, all of them were strong. I mean, you know, I guess to get repetitive storms is not that unusual, but to get three storms in quick succession of the magnitude that we have seen, I think that's pretty rare. And, you know, now it looks like we're looking at a fourth, you know, later in the week. So I think that's pretty unusual weather.
When you and I talked in January 2017, a year ago almost, TV news was running graphics of the Arctic vortex, and we discussed what that means for climatologists versus the weather forecasters. But it looked like a big bulge of cold falling down into the U.S. But this year, it seems like the Arctic was split into two, that cold, with some hitting the West and another blast hitting the U.K. and Northern Europe. So was it different this year?
Yeah, it was different this year than last year. You know, last year we had these polar vortex disruptions And, you know, following these polar vortexes, especially, you get this increased probability of severe winter weather. There was like some minor polar vortex disruptions in February, and that actually brought a lot of snowfall to New England. And then we had that very cold March. And before that, was very mild. You know, this year we've had two of these polar vortex disruptions. We had a minor one in December, and that was followed by the historic cold in the northeastern U.S. and that bomb cyclone. And then we had a much more major polar vortex disruption in February. And the impact from that one was more widespread across the northern hemisphere than any, that we see earlier in the winter or anything compared to last winter. When initially the polar vortex became weakened or disrupted, the initial response, the atmospheric response, was for this cold that kind of built up in, well, the cold had been building up in Siberia over some time. January is very cold in Siberia, but when we had that polar vortex disruption in February, it's got like that opened up the gates, and all that cold air from Siberia spilled out across Europe and reached the United Kingdom, and there was record cold and these disruptive snowfalls, and we have Rome and Madrid and Ireland had all this, again, this for them unusual snowfall. Actually, here in North America, the initial response to that polar vortex disruption was cold, actually, in the western U.S., which I think is somewhat unusual. But I think the polar vortex disruption wasn't typical, but it was cold. And then snow. I mean, in a lot of ways, that polar vortex disruption maybe saved the West from a more dire winter, a very dry and really lack of snow. So they, since that polar vortex disruption, things have definitely improved. As the impacts from that polar vortex disruption continued or kind of maybe progressed, that kind of stormy and cold weather, transitioned from the western U.S. to the eastern U.S. And now here in the Northeast, we've turned much colder. I mean, I know in Boston anyway, March is going to be a colder month than February. That's a pretty rare event. Happened last year as well, so a rare event 2 years in a row. But and of course, we've had kind of this snow blitz here in the Northeast. I mean, I actually went skiing last week in Vermont in Mount Snow, and that had to have been the best snow conditions I could ever remember in the Northeast. I mean, it was so much powder, no ice. I mean, very rare. It really felt like I was skiing in the West. So it's been, a wild ride, I would say, this winter with, these large swings and this extreme weather that we've seen.
Even the TV weathermen, Judah, are starting to say the words sudden stratospheric warming. It sounds scary, but most of us don't have a clue what that means or why it matters. Can you help us with that?
Now, start a little scientifically, maybe I'll transition to some maybe analogies that might make it easier to at least get some kind of comprehension. So in the stratosphere, that's where the polar vortex resides, and it's an area of low pressure. And in the northern hemisphere, the winds circulate around low pressure counterclockwise. So you have a low pressure sitting right over the North Pole, the winds blow from west to east across the entire northern hemisphere. And when this polar vortex is quiet or strong, and those winds blow very quickly, it's a fast-flowing ribbon or stream of air, it acts as a kind of a delineation or, kind of as a barrier where it separates cold air to the north and warm air to the south. And if that warm air tries to invade the Arctic region, it's kind of deflected off the wind that blows around the polar vortex. I mean, I was speaking with a friend to try and explain it, and I kind of used an analogy. You could think of it like a bowl, right? So cold temperatures in the atmosphere column it's thinner. The atmospheric column is thinner. And that's why we say low pressure, because cold air is denser. Where it's warmer, it's thicker because the air is lighter. It expands more. And if it kind of, across the northern hemisphere, kind of forms the shape of like a bowl. And the cold air kind of sinks into the center of the bowl, right? If you have any cold air, and sinks into that polar vortex in a way. So the cold air really resides right over the pole. And when you get these sudden stratospheric warmings, the air warms rapidly inside in the polar vortex and in around the Arctic, and it's like you flip the bowl over, right? So instead of it being low in the middle of the bowl, right, now it's bulging upwards in the center, right? So all that cold air that is collected, in that center of the bowl now has to roll, air always flows, down the gradient. So that cold air that was over the Arctic now kind of rolls down into the lower latitudes. And that's what we call a sudden stratospheric warming, or I like to refer to as a polar vortex disruption.
You made it. I understood it.
You understood it, yeah. So just, yeah, think of it as just as a, you know, normally have a bowl and just so you reverse the bowl and what was originally going into the center of the bowl is now flowing out to the, you know, edges of the bowl.
So who established that the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the global average and when?
Well, this was just observing it. I mean, it started in the 1990s. Up until the 1990s, you know, there's been some oscillations in the temperatures, but in general they have been warming, and the Arctic and the rest of the globe were kind of warming at the same rate. But if you plot the temperatures since 1990, both the Arctic separately and, let's say, the mid-latitudes or the rest of the northern hemisphere, you can see that there's kind of this divergence where the two temperature trends are separating from each other, and the Arctic is warming much faster. I mean, I like to use the year 1990. Some other people maybe start that Arctic warming or accelerate Arctic warming later in that decade, maybe like around 1998. But so the 1990s or so, that's when we really observe, we witness this accelerated Arctic warming, where it's warming twice the rate of the rest of the hemisphere.
Now, here on the ground, we in the public rely mainly on cold or warm. We count on the temperatures, but your analysis in your new paper relies more on pressure, and I guess that's something that meteorologists depend on more. Why is there that separation? What are the relationships there?
Yeah, I mean, I like to look at pressure. Again, there's a little bit of a technical term, but it's a geopotential high, which includes both the surface pressure and the temperature of the atmospheric column. I think it's more of an inclusive index, so it has kind of this dynamic component to it, which is related to the pressure. You know, and it's like what you would associate on a weather map with high pressure and low pressure. And then there's this other component, the temperature. I mean, the debate in the science is saying that, but the fact that the Arctic is warming, that could be possibly influencing our weather in the mid-latitudes. Obviously, I'm a big proponent of that idea, something I've been pushing for quite a while. So we use both indices or metrics, both the geopotential high, maybe call it pressure, people understand that better, and then temperature. But we found this, basically the same relationship when, again, for our study, higher pressure is the equivalent or nearly the equivalent of warmer temperatures. And just for the reason that I said, because warmer temperatures are more expansive, so the atmosphere column is thicker, and cold temperatures are thinner. It's more dense. So we found this relationship that when pressure's high across the Arctic, or, you know, again, that would be the equivalent of warm temperatures across the Arctic, then we see an increase in severe winter weather, you know, here in the northeastern U.S., the eastern U.S. in general. That relationship did fall apart as you got into the western U.S. It was either mixed or some cities it was the exact opposite, so that a cold Arctic or low pressure in the Arctic was related to more severe winter weather and a warm Arctic to less severe winter weather. So, I mean, and there have been other studies that have said that this, we've seen kind of this dipole pattern where it's been kind of mild and dry in the western U.S. and cold and stormy in the eastern U.S., you know, something that's happening more and more frequently than it used to. And I think, in our study, it's consistent with what other people have been reporting.
Now, as we speak, Judah Cohen, the Arctic sea ice maximum for the winter is being set, and this year's winter maximum, if it isn't the lowest ever, it's close. Is that a factor in the storminess we've seen further south?
I mean, I would say yes. I mean, our study says that factors that are contributing to a warm Arctic favor more severe winter weather, and we showed in this article, maybe something that was, you know, a little bit different. Most previous studies have been really focused on temperature. Here we also included snowfall, and when a warmer Arctic is more favorable for heavier snowfalls in the eastern U.S. So and we also this relationship with the polar vortex and the sun stratospheric warming, that you get this increase in severe winter weather for multiple weeks following what we were talking about earlier, sun stratospheric warmings or a weakened polar vortex. So, you know, we had this big polar vortex disruption in February. So I think, you know, clearly the pattern we've had since the end of February, you know, after that initial kind of, it was July and February weather that we had, but, I mean, it settled into this very stormy, unusually stormy pattern. I think it's clearly related to the sun's drastic warming and a warmer Arctic in general. And if you remember, also there were some stories in the media about, you know, like north of Greenland being, you know, well above freezing, and it was really unusual and, I don't know, 50 degrees above normal type story. So, I mean, I think it's all related. I think it's all part of, you know, two sides of one coin, or, you know, it's all part of the same phenomenon. That was a kind of our argument in this most recent paper.
So I'm going to make a statement here, and then I'm going to ask you if I'm right or wrong about it. But is it fair to say that it's possible our winters may get generally warmer along with global warming, but that during certain periods, say from mid-January, mid-February, or even into March, we can expect in some parts of the continents snowier and colder storms to hit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's very consistent with what we showed. We, you know, we looked at the trend in severe winter weather, you know, a daily trend, starting from, you know, December through the end of February. We didn't really look at March, though we had snowfall was included in the analysis. And for the first part of the winter, there isn't much of a trend in severe winter weather in the eastern U.S., but there's a positive trend starting in the mid to late part of the winter. So, I think it's exactly right. I think there's these offsetting or canceling type of forces that are going on. You have this just general warming of the whole globe, and that's leading to mild winter weather. I mean, I don't see any other way around it. But I do think there's this kind of, and that's like a thermodynamic, you know, response to climate change. I think something that's been surprising and really not something that we anticipated or expected is that there's this dynamic response to climate change, in particular Arctic change, where this Arctic is, you know, is warming more rapidly than the rest of the globe. And that dynamic response actually can lead to these episodes of more severe winter weather. But typically this polar vortex interaction, you know, doesn't happen until January or February. That's when, you know, it doesn't really happen in the first part of the winter. So, you know, so I think what you describe is exactly consistent with our ideas.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Judah Cohen, a research climatologist from Atmospheric and Environmental Research. We're talking about why winter nastiness can strike the northeastern United States and many parts of northern Asia, even as the Arctic is warming rapidly and as the whole world is slowly warming. Now, supposing I run a major trucking operation of some kind, or could even be military, and I'm going to move a lot of things in January, but I could do it in February. But I don't want my trucks fouled up in deep snowstorms. Based on your science, can I check with your company to see what the Arctic suggests will be happening 2 weeks from now?
Yes, absolutely. And we do have an operational seasonal forecast, and we do consult with clients on those type of issues. And I also have a weekly blog that talks about, mostly focuses on the Arctic and how the Arctic is impacting the weather across the, you know, northern hemisphere. I mean, I saw there was kind of this vacuum. Climate scientists or seasonal forecasters were really, their efforts were focused on the tropics using things like El Nino Southern Oscillation. In shorthand, you know, an acronym is ENSO, maybe your audience is familiar with. Something that's been used more recently is the Majorian Oscillation, or the MJO, that is not, as I think, as well known as ENSO. But these are tropical phenomena that have to do with activity in the tropics, weather. ENSO is sea surface temperatures, and Majorian Oscillation is convection in the tropics. And so I felt like, you know, that was kind of, there was this monopoly, you know, on the tropics. And I've been, again, trying to put forth these ideas that the Arctic, or if at one point wasn't that important in influencing our weather, it's only gotten to the point where it is important, you know, with these really dramatic changes that are going on in the Arctic. So this blog it really focuses on using Arctic variability to try to explain and understand what's happening now, but also, you know, trying to predict what will happen in the coming weeks, even months. So, I mean, certainly your audience can check that blog. It's called the Arctic Oscillation / Polar Vortex blog. I mean, polar vortex should be, you know, seems like an appropriate name given everything we've discussed. But it should be fairly easy to find if you just Google search Judah Cohen and AO blog or something like that. But just a Judah Cohen Google search, or the blog will come up like one or this first or second.
Okay, and I'll put a link in my show blog at ecoshock.org as well.
Much appreciated, yeah. So anyway, it's easy enough to find.
All right, now, do your observations of a warmer Arctic, colder continents agree with predictions made by most of the climate models? And if not, what does that tell us?
No, they don't. the models, a criticism, I'd say the most common criticism of my ideas is that the models really don't show it. But I think the models are flawed. I think this winter was a great example of it. The models never really showed any kind of cold weather the whole winter. I mean, not just the United States, but also for Europe and Siberia. Even the model forecast made in January for the month of February showed uniformly warm across all of Eurasia, maybe not as warm across North America, but I'm sure they forecasted warm in North America, which actually, Eastern North America just may not have been a bad forecast. But certainly it was not the accurate forecast for Northern Asia and Europe, which turned out to have a pretty cold month of February, and which continued into March. I think they just don't simulate they don't reproduce the interactions that take place at high latitudes, and they have and I've documented in papers along with other colleagues, the flaws or the shortcomings of the models, especially when it comes to handling of the polar vortex, which I think is obviously critical to my ideas and this kind of bridge between a warming Arctic and cold continents idea. So
your new paper reiterates what both you and Jennifer Francis have said in the past. You have observations of a relationship, but no proof yet of a mechanism or a cause. Is there any hope for that mechanism becoming known? And what about the idea of teleconnection?
Yeah, so I think the paper does break some new ground, but that idea, I guess the general idea is not necessarily new. I mean, most of the research on this topic is actually focused on Eurasia. Our paper focused on eastern United States, so that was also somewhat new. And we both Jennifer and I have kind of put out maybe competing ideas, different mechanisms, how this works. Hers is more through the jet stream. Mine has been through the polar vortex. So we have a mechanism, though it's hard to prove it with just an observational analysis. I mean, people, I think more climate scientists would be persuaded if we could show the mechanism very cleanly in these modeling experiments, which until now has kind of been fleeting or, is really not, we've not been able to demonstrate. But I think if we kind of, if we approach the models with the assumption that they're flawed and they need to be fixed, I think the models can be modified and improved so that they do demonstrate or support this mechanism. But I do think that the models need, they need modifications. I think the models as they are just, simply flawed. I mean, that's my opinion. I mean, someone obviously, maybe a critic might say, well, there's nothing wrong with the models. It's your idea that needs, improving and fixing. But I would point out the models really fell short pretty dramatically, with their forecast this winter. And, if the models were anywhere near, even not perfect, but close to being perfect or certainly don't need big modifications, then they should have done a better job than they did with their forecasts.
And this all puts us in a really tough position because we have to explain to simplistic climate deniers that, yes, these awful winter storms may very well be signs of climate change.
Yeah, I've actually been accused in the past of being a climate change denier. Both sides, climate change denier, climate change apologist. Both sides have been accused of being on both sides at the same time. But I mean, I think that, it's better. I mean, because it increases skepticism when you're saying it's going to be warmer, it's going to be warmer, winters are going to disappear. And then all of a sudden people have this, shock of cold to weather and big snowstorms. And if it's one thing that happened once, I mean, people say, well, it's just a random event, and it's cold and it's snowy, it's just a random event. But it keeps repeating itself. And I mean, how many times does it have to repeat itself when you finally say, it's no longer random? And I think if you have an explanation, I think that helps. I think that really helps with trying to make the general public understand climate change. And again, I think the best really support of a hypothesis is being able to use it to make a better prediction. I certainly think that, I have been able to demonstrate improved predictability compared to the models and using other ideas, in climate science. So, what you said is you're preaching to the choir there, but I mean, I think it would really help explain and help the general public understand climate change. And just because we didn't anticipate it initially doesn't make the idea wrong. I mean, I think we need to be open to that there are surprises. I mean, this is not, you know, it's not a perfect science, and our understanding is certainly not complete or perfect, and there are things that are going to happen that we just didn't anticipate or expect ahead of time.
But do you think it's possible that there could still be years when we have a relatively colder Arctic and so a better winter for people in the American northern and eastern states? I mean, these things go back and forth, or is it just a progression and this is our new state?
Yes, I mean, you certainly can have a pretty mild winter even with a warm Arctic. I mean, it's not always. I mean, the past two winters weren't too bad. I mean, you know, there were episodes, but I mean, overall, they were pretty mild, at least here in the, you know, this, I'm thinking about North America as a whole. But, you know, I think getting to a cold Arctic, I mean, I think the Arctic could turn cold for short periods. I mean, but it seems to be getting really hard to get a cold Arctic for an entire winter. I mean, just there's so much less sea ice. Not only is it, you know, is the extent of the sea ice much less, right? So it covers a much smaller area. But the thickness, the volume of that ice, I think is at least or more, you know, more dramatic than even the extent of the ice. So even if there is a thin, you know, veneer of ice in the, over the Arctic Ocean, there's still heat that can come out of the Arctic because the ice is so thin. Plus, I mean, the whole system is warmer, and, you know, the air masses and the ocean, you know, the ocean waters, they're mixing all the time. And so, you know, there's constantly more and more heat being transported into the Arctic. And it seems like once it gets there, it's hard for it to get out. I don't remember the last time we had a cold, you know, cold Arctic winter. I think, you know, that might be a, never say never. I'm not, you know, so certainly I could see the Arctic having a cold winter. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's going to become a very, much more rare thing, and much harder, I think, to happen.
So you've suggested in the new paper that we might get this increased storminess, especially in January or February, the colder continent effect, if you want to call it that, during a transition period of Arctic warming. So our question is, if this is the new reality, how long is that transition period?
Yeah, so it's hard to know. I mean, I do think that, you know, the warming now is kind of regionalized. I mean, at least there's kind of these bullseyes where the warming is focused. It's not kind of uniform or spread evenly throughout the Arctic. And I think it's the fact that it's, you know, it's in these certain regions that makes it favorable for weakening the polar vortex. If it became kind of uniform, let's say all the sea ice disappeared and the warming just became uniform throughout the Arctic, then, I mean, this, every, you know, kind of this mechanism that I, at least that I've kind of discussed, I think it might go away. And then we would just be left with, you know, just really mild winters. I mean, there's always, you know, the oddball chance of getting, you know, a cold winter, but overall, it would be very hard to overcome just the, you know, the overwhelming warming that's occurring. So it's hard to know, but I do think this mechanism that at least that I have argued for might be dependent on at least, you know, some sea ice, you know, existing. I mean, there'll always be sea ice certainly in the winter, but if it's just a very thin seasonal sea ice and the warming is just, you know, kind of spread evenly throughout the Arctic, I think my mechanism that I've been arguing really could disappear.
I may not live long enough to see that, though.
Well, there's some forecast, you know, the Arctic will be ice-free, you know, in like, you know, 10 years or so. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, but it's hard. All these things are hard. There's, you know, there's natural variability in the system. You know, it oscillates naturally regardless, you know, of these outside forcing, you know, say the forcing, you know, from human-induced climate change. But, you know, it's a complicated system, and there are a lot of, you know, moving wheels, moving parts, and it's hard to anticipate all of them, you know, ahead of time. I think that's, you know, certainly a lesson that I've taken, what's happened. You know, again, I mean, when I was in grad school or, you know, or starting out, everybody said, you know, winter is over. It's going to be hard to get, you know, this, you know, really deep cold is kind of record cold and heavy snowfall, all that's going to soon disappear. And that I would argue, hasn't been the case. That surprised me, and I think it surprised a lot of people.
Absolutely. You know, in 2002 or 3, I got a recording from Environment Canada saying that winters would be warmer and nights would be warmer, and that's what to expect with climate change. 2006, I did a show, Will There Still Be Winter Sports? And I talked to people in Aspen who said, we don't know. Maybe there won't be enough snow, but you just went skiing and it was great.
Yeah, no, best ever. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, it's definitely again, winter has hanged in there much more strongly than certainly the field anticipated. There's a very marked warming trend, throughout the year and throughout the three seasons, spring, summer, and fall. Winter was supposed to warm the fastest of all the four seasons, but it's actually turned out the opposite. And I'm talking about across the continents, the U.S., Europe, Asia. But it's warmed the least, and that's been surprising. And, expect the unexpected, I think.
Three-season warming and one-season cooling, and that's possibly because of changes in the Arctic. We're going to have to leave it there. From Lexington, Massachusetts, we've been speaking with Dr. Judah Cohen. He works with the Parsons Lab at MIT and for the forecasting company Atmospheric and Environmental Research. Judah is the lead author of a new study just published in Nature Communications, Warm Arctic Episodes Linked with Increased Frequency of Extreme Winter Weather in the United States. Judah, thank you for joining us again on Radio EcoShock. I hope to talk again, next year.
All right, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. It is hard to accept that winters in the Northern Hemisphere can get worse, even as the planet heats up, due to the way warming strikes the Arctic first and hardest. The models did not predict it, as you heard, but the facts are plain. We still don't know with certainty the mechanism that connects a hotter Arctic to dirtier winters in a wide band further south. It could be the jet stream change. It could be sudden warming in the stratosphere, followed by a changed polar vortex pushing down south. We don't know yet. But what we have to know is that it is happening. It's another case of when you heat up a planet too quickly, the unexpected happens, and it isn't always nice.
Radio EcoShock.
I will warn you, our next interview contains a few words of scientific jargon that I didn't know and you may not know. Don't let that bother you, because each response from Dr. Allen is likely to contain some serious news from the science front. I will put a glossary of any troubling terms in my show blog that's published Wednesday at ecoshock.org. I think you're in for a look at science that gathers all the new skills from genetic exploration to satellites and puts it together along with the old skills and a touch of genius.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We have new science about how our carbon dumping strikes the food chain and world oceans, plus how that could reduce ocean storage of carbon, meaning our emissions might hit us faster and harder. To get there, we have to peer into microscopic creatures, zip from 700 million years ago to the latest genetic sequencing tech, and understand how we get iron we all need to live. It's a big journey, it's a big paper, too big for one show, but we will give it a shot. With our guest, scientist Dr. Andrew E. Allen. Andrew is a joint associate professor working with the J. Craig Venter Institute and the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California. From La Jolla, California, Andy Allen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great, thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, there's a half dozen ways to approach this big paper. Why don't we start with something we all understand? Our bodies need the right amount of iron to stay healthy. Too little, we get anemia. Too much, it's poison. Why do living things on Earth need iron?
Well, that's a good question. Iron happens to be a very good element for transferring electrons. And so the electron transfer reactions, primarily in animal mitochondria, which drive generation of ATP through oxidative phosphorylation, which involves passing electrons down cytochromes, iron is a very handy atom for that. So also similarly in the chloroplast of photosynthetic organisms, which is responsible for conversion of light energy into chemical energy, iron is really important for the electron transfer reaction. So in these critical energy-generating aspects of chloroplast and mitochondria, iron is really important. And then it's important for other enzyme complexes in cells also. And interestingly, prior to the oxygenation of the planet, iron was a lot more plentiful in seawater. because it was existed in its dissolved form more easily in cells and organisms. You could say developed maybe an addiction to it because it was really available. But since the advent of photosynthesis and the widespread oxygenation of the planet, iron has become much more scarce over the past billion years, but organisms still harbor this ancient requirement and need for it. That's one way to think about it, or just a small slice of how to begin to think about it.
So we had to get smarter, or single-celled creatures had to get smarter about how to grab it if it's harder to get.
That's exactly right, yeah. Right, and then you know, as you mentioned, and pathogenic microbes inside, you know, larger, more complex eukaryotes, keeping iron away from pathogenic microbes is a way to defend against pathogenicity. So controlling the battle for iron among and between microbes has pivotal outcomes for ecological and host pathogen dynamics. What we knew before this study and has been known for some decades is that eukaryotic algae in the ocean must have extremely high affinity binding mechanisms for iron. But what we didn't know was exactly how that worked. And for a long time, a lot of research was based on trying to validate for eukaryotic algae a system analogous to what happens in yeast, because yeast are eukaryotic microbes that are similar to algae. But it doesn't appear that they do it like yeast. Instead, they have a mechanism that is more animal-like. It was just so distant that we didn't really recognize it initially.
So you were investigating the genetic makeup of phytoplankton, I gather, and you find zillions of them. That's the technical term, zillions, by the way, in the Southern Ocean, have a gene in common, but you don't know what it does. Can you talk to us briefly about discovering the purpose of those genes and then that weird thing of substituting iron capture genes between very different creatures?
Yeah, right. So this research started some years ago for me when I was doing a postdoc, you know, after graduate school, before I could find a real job in Paris. I was doing a postdoc in Paris, and this was the mid-2000s. And at that time, we were using a technology called EST sequencing, express tag sequencing. And basically what that is just trying to sequence all of the mRNA that a cell has at a given snapshot in, you know, physiological time. So you might stress cells for nitrogen or phosphorus, or you expose them to low pH or low temperature, you know, whatever kind of ecological or, you know, abiotic variable you're interested in, and then, you know, sequence the mRNA that is expressed, you know, as the cells transition to this regime you've exposed them to. So that was kind of state of the art, right, around 2007. And so, you know, being interested in ecophysiology and biochemistry of diatoms, which is this type of eukaryotic phytoplankton that we're interested in, you know, a logical thing to do is expose them to iron stress, because major parts of the ocean are, in fact, iron limited. And the Southern Ocean is a very good example of that, where you have high concentrations of nutrients like nitrate in the surface ocean where there's sunlight, but very low chlorophyll. And that's an anomaly. And so they're called a high nutrient, low chlorophyll regions. And those were sort of considered paradoxical in oceanography for decades, until eventually it was established that most of these so-called high-nutrient, low-chlorophyll regions were actually a result of iron limitation. So the micronutrient iron was so limiting that phytoplankton weren't available to draw down the nitrate. And, I mean, nitrate is such an important resource that it's just unusual to find it above, you know, one micromole anywhere in the surface ocean, except in these iron-limited regions. And interestingly, one reason that chemical oceanographers didn't know that iron was limiting in these regions is because the ships they were using to take samples were contaminating water with iron. So it wasn't until people figured out how to sample with equipment that wasn't made out of iron and steel, so people would, you know, scientists got on Zodiac boats and drove them, you know, a kilometer or two away from the ship and took samples with Teflon sampling equipment and Kevlar lines and things like that, and realized that iron concentrations were really just exceedingly low in the, you know, picomolar or less range. So in 2007, we did these experiments where we captured all of the mRNA of iron-starved diatoms, and we discovered these genes that we cleverly called iron starvation-induced proteins. I say cleverly because I'm kidding. Yeah, it wasn't a very creative name. But then oceanographers started seeing them everywhere, and we just called them ISIPs because we didn't really know what they were. And then in this study, a graduate student, PhD student, Jeff McQuaid, who's finished his PhD now, Dr. Jeff McQuaid, was following up on some of this work. And as PhD students are wont to do, late at night, he was trying to understand why people hadn't come up with better hypotheses for what these genes do. And he started looking below the detection limit of what, you know, a scientist might normally consider as significant for similarity to another gene. So, you know, normally a computer algorithm would say that, you know, gene A looks like gene B if they're maybe, you know, at least 25% similar to one another. And, you know, this ISIP2 at the time wasn't 25% similar to anything. But he did notice that in certain regions, it had some similarity to human transferrin. And overall, the protein was maybe about 8 or 10% similar. But the regions where it was similar are the regions that transferrin requires for binding iron. And so that's what really got him going. That was his sort of initial, very cautious eureka moment. And then we were fortunate that we and others around that time had developed new techniques for making knockouts in diatoms, so, you know, actually being able to knock out genes. And so he was able to make knockouts in the diatom and then introduce human transferrin and different copies of human transferrin, some that had been mutated in particular residues, to really, you know, look in more detail at the function and biochemistry of this protein. And his experiment essentially support the idea that, you know, this distant transferrin that we called ISIP2 is in fact an ancient transferrin, which has all kinds of interesting implications because, you know, transferrin is a very sort of famous protein in the eukaryotic biology, biochemistry world, and it's always believed to have originated and evolved in multicellular organisms or vertebrates. But it turns out that it, in fact, has its evolutionary origins in this ancient protistin soup.
Wow. That is beautiful stuff. And I loved your story of the iron ships polluting it. It reminded me a little bit of Einstein talking about when you look into the depths of atoms that your instruments contaminate whatever it is you're trying to deal with.
Yeah, that's exactly right, especially with trace metals.
Yeah. Okay, now enter a new actor, which is our carbon dioxide pollution, which is in the atmosphere, but it drops into the ocean. The ocean has been described as absorbing up to 90% of the excess carbon dioxide we've been dumping. How does that play into what we're describing here about iron gathering in diatoms?
Right. So it turns out that this protein, well, there's mammalian transferrin, so this circulates in human blood. And then there's one detail that I didn't mention, which will get to the answer to your question also, which is that ISIP2, which we now call phytotransferrin, is not actually directly related to transferrin in that they don't share a transferrin common ancestor. But what they do is they both share a common ancestor and an ancient bacterial protein that is not a transferrin. It appears to be some type of generic paraplasmic binding protein. And the evolutionary descendants of this paraplasmic binding protein on one hand are multicellular organism containing transferrins, the classical ones that are in the biology textbooks, and then a whole completely different lineage that is these phytotransferrins. So what we say is that these phytotransferrins and transferrins are evolutionary analogs of one another. So it's sort of like convergent evolution, but a little bit different. And so this ancient paraplasmic binding protein in bacteria requires a anion, in the case of this paraplasmic binding protein, it's phosphate, to act as a cofactor to bind substrates. And it turns out that this anion on the road to the evolution of transferrin in one lineage and the road to the evolution of phytotransferrin in the other lineage, there was a substitution of this anion cofactor from phosphate to carbonate. And so carbonate, it turns out, is a very good molecule to coordinate iron binding in the pocket of this protein. And so this protein needs a carbonate anion in its pocket. You can think of it like a catcher's mitt, really, and it'll just kind of go out and survey the water, and if it has a carbonate in its pocket already, it can snag an iron. But if it doesn't have that carbonate, it literally cannot coordinate the binding of the iron. So they really require one another. So this is interesting, right? Because, of course, in the, you know, early 21st century, we're in a situation where the You know, the pH of the ocean has already decreased a bit from industrial times, you know, from 8.15 to 8.01 or something like that. And, you know, one of the biggest problems that organisms face in an acidified ocean is inability to precipitate calcium carbonate. So a lot of marine organisms require calcium carbonate to make their cell wall or their shell. So crustaceans and corals, and some phytoplankton. But diatoms don't require calcium carbonate. And in fact, many experiments that have evaluated the physiology of diatoms at high CO2 and lower pH really show no effect. But it turns out that if they're growing at a moderately low iron environment, they require carbonate for this process that, you know, people who study the effects of ocean acidification on the ocean hadn't really considered as a major, you know, carbonate-requiring physiological process, because it's not the obvious kind that, you know, involves precipitation of calcium carbonate.
So a more acidic ocean in some way hampers the ability of these organisms to grab the iron they need to live.
Well, that's what it looks like in the experiments that we've done so far. You know, and importantly, in our paper, we describe the iron uptake mechanism in diatoms and document the role of the importance of carbonate. But, you know, we did these experiments on a laboratory model, so an organism that we've brought from the ocean, you know, into flasks and test tubes and grow azenically, right, so without any other algae or bacteria. The obvious question is, what is the effect of this in the field, of course, where things are much more complex? But the model organism laboratory data certainly suggests that carbonate availability decreased by high CO2 decreases the ability of diatoms to acquire this important iron source. And, you know, when you extrapolate our data that's reported in the paper to what climate scientists refer to as, you know, business as usual scenario, right? In other words, no mitigation for the year 2100. So you have an 800 parts per million atmosphere for CO2. It looks like iron uptake by diatoms via this mechanism might be decreased by as much as 45%.
Well, that's an oh my God moment, but we'll get to that as far as the climate goes. But I think it also has to be said that the population of phytoplankton determines global fisheries and all the wonderful creatures in the sea. But we also should be clear that there isn't iron shortages in the whole ocean. It's just some parts of the ocean?
Well, yeah, so that's an interesting thing to consider. So, you know, we talked earlier about why cells have such a high iron requirement, and it's because, you know, in ancient times or in an ancient ocean, iron was very plentiful, and iron is actually, you know, a very abundant element in marine ecosystems. So it's in sediments and it's in riverine environments. And in fact, the major, we talked a little bit about these so-called HNLC regions, high nutrient, low chlorophyll regions that are driven by iron and availability. So these occur in the Southern Ocean, in the Equatorial Pacific, and in the subarctic North Pacific. So major regions of the world's oceans, but they also are the regions that are, you know, most distant from riverine or atmospheric input. I mean, the ocean receives a very, very large amount of iron via dust deposition. So the Atlantic Ocean, parts of it would be iron limited, but there's dust coming from Sahara and other places that are you know, driving iron fertilization, natural iron fertilization events. So these iron limited regions tend to be remote, but that's just a preface to say that in upwelling environments that we wouldn't typically think of as, you know, having the remote geographic characteristics of iron-limited regions, so like the California Current, you know, off the coast of Monterey Bay, or the Peruvian upwelling, they do, in fact, display a surprisingly high level of iron limitation temporally. So what will happen is a parcel of upwelled water that's full of nutrients will get up into the sunlit surface layer and get stripped out of all of the nutrients, and they will run out of iron often before they run out of nitrate or silica. So some oceanographers have described a mosaic of iron limitation, even in coastal upwelling environments. It just happens, you know, in discrete temporal windows, dependent on the stage of bloom formation and associated nutrient depletion. So iron limitation, although not a chronic feature in some coastal high fisheries productivity regions, is still probably an important factor. And also a lot of coastal upwelling waters are acidified. So you have this scenario of somewhat low pH and very, very strong demand for nutrients where the bloom basically could slam into to iron limitation maybe earlier than it otherwise would. And yeah, that's something that we'd like to take a closer look at.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Andrew E. Allen from the Scripps Institution and from the J. Craig Venter Institute. We're talking about how our carbon dumping into the atmosphere changes ocean chemistry, affecting the basis of the food chain. And you know where this leads, Andy. All the people who have called for iron fertilization to save sea life will feel vindicated by this new research and demand geoengineering with iron dumping. Your thoughts?
Well, gee, that's a loaded question. I just say loaded because it's complicated, and really there's a lot of things to consider beyond what our research touches on here. So for example, I mean, I think that some of the research on iron dumping suggests that the mixed layer conditions have to be, you know, exactly right with regard to winds and currents and depth, you know, to lead to these sort of export events that might really result in driving fixed carbon out of the euphotic zone. And, you know, so that goes way beyond the kind of things that we're thinking about. But another issue that I think that people should consider when thinking about such experiments is that, so as an aside, I mean, it's not in this paper, but we've been doing some experiments in the Southern Ocean over the past few years where we increase iron availability and change temperature in small experimental bottles. And we've noticed the prevalence of Pseudonychia blooms. Okay, so Pseudonychia is a harmful algae that produces domoic acid. That's another big environmental problem. And then harmful algae in general are a problem that people need to think about. And, you know, just dumping a whole bunch of iron into the ocean is a complex endeavor with consequences that are really hard to predict, from, you know, how much carbon you're going to export, which is probably important for giving people credit for whoever are funding it. And then secondly, the consequences, you know, through the food web, from everything from harmful algae to other unintended consequences are just difficult to predict. So I would probably advocate for a whole bunch more research before anybody really proposed that with any seriousness.
I agree with you. And there's the other issue of, is it the right form of iron? I was looking into research by scientists Elizabeth Schoenfeld and Benjamin Bostick at Columbia, talking about how iron from glaciers was the best for phytoplankton. And so it's probably not enough to just grind up some iron and toss it off the back of a ship. I'd like to move on a little bit towards the ocean carbon feedback, the climate impact. How do the results of this study tie back into the expectations of CO2 being absorbed by the ocean?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So very many models of global CO2 absorption by the ocean are driven in part by, well, certainly driven by nutrient availability, but iron availability is a major part of that, and it's certainly a major feature in geological timescale models that attempt to consider variability in the amount of CO2 the ocean has sequestered in different geological eras. You know, so iron availability has varied a lot over geological time, and that's believed to be a, you know, major constraining variable with regard to the efficiency with which biological consumption of CO2 has driven global ocean CO2 sequestration. So first of all, aside from the impact of rising CO2 on carbonate availability over the coming decades and centuries, you know, there's just an enormous variability currently in carbonate availability in the ocean according to temperature and currents and origin of seawater. And I think that modelers, you know, people who really consider the impact of the distribution of dissolved iron on CO2 uptake will start to consider the impact of carbonate availability. And I'm really excited to see what results from that. I've already been in contact with a few experts in this area to start to think about, you know, how to approach this. But our laboratory data certainly suggests that it's an important variable to consider.
Well, this could be a feedback mechanism that I'd never heard about. I mean, we add carbon to the atmosphere. It goes into the sea, which reduces the amount of carbon going into the sea because the phytoplankton can't get the iron they need, which increases the carbon in the atmosphere.
Yeah, it's a negative feedback.
In the grand scale of things, could this be a serious feedback loop?
Possibly, but it's just really hard to predict because, as we point out, this really specifically impacts one particular iron uptake pathway. Okay, so the pathway for dissolved ferric iron, which is by far the most scarce form of dissolved iron in sunlit layer of the ocean, but It's the most energetically preferred form and supplies, you know, around half of phytoplankton iron demand. But you know, one thing that was sort of a footnote from our study, but was, you know, I thought extremely interesting, is that uptake pathways for other forms of iron do not seem to be affected by carbonate and seem to be driven by other genes and proteins. So it's hard to predict how those pathways might compensate or, you know, result in, you know, different kinds of ecological associations and symbioses and alliances, cooperation, conflict between, you know, so phytoplankton and algae are, you know, sometimes we think of them as maybe a social network where some are responsible for acquiring some goods and others consume some goods and resources. And particularly with regard to organic iron substrates, which are produced by bacteria, you could imagine a situation where if, you know, phytoplankton are having difficulty acquiring dissolved ferric iron, that they could form relationships with bacteria that perhaps give them easier access to other forms of iron that, you know, albeit don't appear to be as labile or support the levels of photosynthesis and productivity that dissolved ferric iron does. So it's hard to extrapolate what the big picture implications are in terms of feedbacks, but it's certainly something I hadn't thought about before, and the data are quite compelling, and I think that, you know, people who model this kind of thing for a living will start to really think about it and pay attention to it.
Well, I think it's fair to say it's still really early days. It's a fairly new discovery, and we're looking at a system that is so complex that even the biggest computer models don't really do it well. So we may just find out in reality.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, another thing that oceanographers have documented and thought about and talked about is that the size structure of the food web might be changing, right, from big cells that require and assimilate a lot of nutrients and really drive ocean carbon assimilation to smaller cells that depend on different forms of nutrients and don't really result in this kind of explosive growth that diatoms do. So you could imagine a regime shift in the types of phytoplankton communities to smaller cells that don't export as much carbon for a variety of reasons, including climate-associated impacts on the mixed layer of nutrient delivery and perhaps, you know, compromised nutrient acquisition systems that result in the kind of thing that we've been talking about.
We've only got a minute left, Andy, but can you tell us a little hint of what you're working on next?
Well, we're working on a whole bunch of things, but one thing in general is to improve synthetic biology methodology to harness some of the features of microalgae, like amino acid synthesis pathways and protein synthesis pathways, and perhaps understand algal metabolism in a level of detail that will allow us to engineer algae to perhaps be more useful than they currently are. And of course, we're continuing to work on understanding fundamental mechanisms of nutrient uptake. And in particular, with regard to iron, it appears that there's a battery of uptake systems aside for this one for ferric iron, including assimilation of organically complexed iron. And we're trying to understand that in a little more detail.
We have been talking with Andrew E. Allen from the Scripps Institute of Oceanography and the J. Craig Venter Institute. The new paper with lead author J.B. McQuaid is titled Carbonate-Sensitive Phytotransferrin Controls High-Affinity Iron Uptake in Diatoms. It was published March 14th in the journal Nature. You can find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thanks so much for your interest in our work. I really appreciate it.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Again, you can find a list of the science terms you might have missed in my show blog, along with links to all the science we talked about at ecoshock.org. It's interesting to me that Dr. Allen kind of downplayed the impact of this iron shortage on carbon capture in the oceans. And it's partly because the science is so new. It is early days. And yet, he says it is possible that up to 45% of the carbon grabbed by these plentiful diatoms could be left in the atmosphere if we continue with business as usual. I've seen articles written about this paper which reach more alarming conclusions. I think scientists, especially good scientists, are very careful. They prefer to stick within the limitations of what we know now rather than projecting into the future. But of course, someone needs to look forward, especially since the shocking future has already appeared here so often, so soon. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock again this week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's Weekly Palestine Podcast.
Now we're going to be speaking with Stephen Gowans. Gowans.wordpress.com is an article, The Largely Unrecognized U.S. Occupation of Syria. I believe Stephen is with us. Are you there, Stephen?
Hello, yes. Hello, Phil. I'm here.
Yeah. Well, this is published March 11. You have raised a touchy issue. today, actually, there was some dramatic news. I noticed it. I checked my Toronto Star and Globe and Mail. They didn't run any photographs, but the president of Syria, President Assad, was in the area called East Ghouta visiting his soldiers and officers and also refugees. And Syrians are quite pleased, of course, at this development, since for some years now that East Ghouta has been the terrorists there have been firing shells into the city of Damascus, killing people. And is apparently the Syrian army is close to victory. But you're pointing out in your article that there's an issue that's going to – the 800-pound gorilla called the United States, and they have put soldiers on the ground. And this is, in your view, is going to be a special kind of test. How extensive is this U.S. Presence?
Well, depends on how you want to measure it. And they've invaded, or the United States has invaded Syria with a significant military force. Now, how significant is it? Well, that's difficult to say. The United States acknowledges that there are 2,000 troops in the northeastern part of Syria, but it earlier said that there were 500 troops, and it revised this upward, calling its previous estimate an artificial construct, which is a euphemism for simply a misrepresentation of the truth. And this current number, 2,000, appears to be an artificial construct as well. It's an artificial construct because the 2,000 include only those who are counted. And it's acknowledged that there are a whole bunch of U.S. special forces and other forces that are not counted. So special operations personnel are not counted. Troops assigned to classified missions are not counted. Contractors or mercenaries the United States hired are not counted. Mm-hmm. Combat air crew, not counted. Mm. Combat air crew are very vital to the enforcement of the occupation. So it's unclear how many U.S. personnel are in Syria. And on top of the military personnel, there are also diplomatic personnel.
Mm-hmm.
Diplomatic personnel, diplomats working with the Kurds, which are their boots on the – well, they call them the boots on the ground.
So we have boots and suits.
Yes, boots and suits, and the suits are establishing new local government structures within this occupied territory.
And how legal is this in your view? Under international law?
Under international law, it's completely illegal. I mean, there's no question about that. The other question is it legal under U.S. law? Do they have authorization to use military force in Syria? And the justification that the White House and the Pentagon put forward is completely indefensible. The authorization they cite is based on a 2001 law, which authorizes the use of military force against the perpetrators of the September 11th. Mm-hmm. The 2002 law authorizing the invasion of Iraq. Now, they say that their presence in northeastern Syria is related to the war against ISIS. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's accept that. Let's assume that's the case. Well, if that's the case, there's still no authorization for the use of military force against ISIS. So they invoke the 2001 law that says that they can use force against al-Qaeda, saying that ISIS is essentially equivalent to al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And the 2002 law authorizing the invasion of Iraq is completely irrelevant, since apparently, according to the Obama administration, the Iraq war is over.
Mm-hmm.
But none of these laws, these U.S. laws, authorize two other key objectives which were articulated by the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. He said there are three objectives for being in Syria. And he announced an indefinite occupation of northeastern Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And the objectives were, number one, to continue to combat ISIS. So there's an indefensible legal authorization presented for that. The second objective is to prevent the Syrian government from recovering its territory. Well, there's no legal authorization offered for that because there is no legal authorization for preventing the legitimate government from recovering its territory. And the third objective, he articulated, was to eclipse Iranian influence in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
For which there's no legal authorization as well.
Could you tell me the third one again? I'm sorry.
To eclipse Iranian influence in Syria.
Well, how could the under international law, there isn't any provision for such a thing, right? You don't like some other country, and therefore you're going to put troops somewhere?
Exactly. Now, there's certain U.S. politicians who've noticed this and have sent letters to the both the Pentagon, to the Department of National Defense in the United States, and to the State Department and said, what's your legal justification? And the reply is, oh, well, you know, maybe the Secretary of State articulated three goals, but there's really only one goal. We're there for ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
So they quickly backtracked on that.
You know, you're telling me this reminds me of the Americans when they introduced torture in Iraq, and the lawyers went to work and found a way to talk about torture without calling it torture.
Mm-hmm.
It's just it's pretty much like the old gangster movies where you hire what they call the mouthpiece and you do whatever you feel like doing and then tell him, you figure it out. I'm paying you to create an excuse or something to get me off on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
This is Stephen Gowans, by the way. Gowans.wordpress.com. The article is The Largely Unrecognized U.S. Occupation of Syria. Incidentally, you point out, too, there seems to be a lot of oil where the U.S. put its troops.
Yes. So the territory they control contains most of Syria's oil and gas wealth, and also most of its arable land.
Mm-hmm.
And the result of that is, and the other interesting thing about this was, during the war against ISIS, the Syrian Arab army and its allies focused on liberating cities.
Mm-hmm.
U.S. military planning or war planning emphasized the capture of oil and gas facility. And they used their tip of the spear, the Kurds, to move south along the Euphrates, capturing oil and gas fields.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is that they now control most of the oil and gas wealth of the Syrian Arab Republic. and have no intention of returning it.
Yeah, there is an echo, I think, of in that. I recall that when Donald Trump was first elected, he went to see the CIA, and he gave a little talk. We all watched him. It was a very peculiar Trump performance, as usual. But he did say about Iraq, we should have kept the oil.
Yeah.
We shouldn't have gone in, but once we're there, we should have kept the oil. Although, by the way, now we're talking about something rather hard to do. I noticed that, and you must have taken note of it, Foreign Minister Lavrov, he is saying what you're saying in that he says this is not a matter of using pawns, or I forget what the expression is, but he says this is actual U.S. direct involvement. He said they're not playing through third parties. They're there. So, no. By the way, when your foreign minister chooses to say that, he's known that for a long time. When he chooses to say it, it puts you in a different kind of problem or situation.
No, precisely, and he's right. I mean, the Kurds are simply used as thin veneer behind which they can carry out this operation, which is illegal. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they don't want to draw attention to this illegal operation, so it's presented as, you know, kind of a Kurd operation with U.S. support. And there's a direct parallel in Yemen, where the war in Yemen is described as a Saudi-led war, but it's really a U.S.-led war. I mean, if you look at all of the documentation on who's running this war, it's the United States, not the Saudis. The Saudis provide pilots to drop bombs, but the United States is running the rest of the operation. And, I mean, it's providing warships for a naval blockade. It refuels Saudi bombers in flight. It collects the intelligence. Flies its own drones and planes over Yemen to select, bombing targets. In fact, there was even an article, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal today, about the operations center in Saudi Arabia, the operations center in which they run this entire war of aggression against Yemen. And within the operations center is a little room they call, I can't recall what they call what it is, but it's a glass room, and inside sit U.S. and British advisors.
Yeah.
And the U.S. and British advisors tell them which targets to select.
Hmm. Yeah, and by the way, and again, as Stephen Gallons, you cite a writer, Ibrahim al-Amin, making this very important point. He made it in relation to the U.S. decision to move its embassy.
Yeah.
And he said, look, that's U.S. policy. That's not Israeli policy. And it's U.S. policy in Yemen, and it's U.S. policy in Syria. That's kind of important to underline, isn't it?
Yes. And then his argument was, you know, Israel is simply a tool of U.S. foreign policy. And Israel wouldn't last a day without U.S. support and U.S. resources. And the same can be said about the Kurds. And the same can be said about the South or Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Saudi Arabia is simply an extension of U.S. foreign policy, mm-hmm. an instrument.
But yes, incidentally, the MSB, I think he's called, or is it BS? Pardon me. He's BS, as I recall. He's in Washington to, I guess, probably receive instructions following your logic here. Okay. I want to mention that people write about this, and I really congratulate you on your approach in getting the issues clear. I saw an article in The Guardian, I think, by Patrick Coburn, and he says, well, the best hope of the situation is that now Russia and U.S. are players in Syria. Therefore, they can probably bring off of some kind of settlement because they're great powers. But he's treating them as equivalent. You've pointed out the United States is not, by their own law, legally in Syria, nor by international law. Talk about the Russian situation.
No, I mean, you're right. The Russians were invited into Syria. by the Syrians. So they're there are legally, as are the Iranians. And yet the United States will rail against the Iranians and rail against the Russians, too, for exerting influence in Syria and the Middle East, challenging U.S. geopolitical primacy. I mean, they're quite open about this. If you read the Bush administration 2017 national security strategy, they complain bitterly about, Russia being in Syria or Iran being in Syria because this is challenging U.S. primacy and challenging U.S. power. And no one can challenge U.S. power.
Yeah, that's the kind of the loud or the visible fact which we can't get politicians here to address. You can get them to talk about don't bomb East Ghouta because there might be a civilian hit. But no one – they will not discuss the U.S. exercising its self-appointed power to kill Syrians and indeed Russians. About a month ago – and this is apropos of your article too – they – kind of let it – there was a little boast that they thought they'd killed 100 Russian soldiers. Apparently there were some Russian contractors but in the area. But describe that, by the way. That's another – you just actually have to – you really want to say we have to stop the discussion because you just said that you're defending yourself against aggression by Syria when you are in Syria. Okay. Can you speak to that? You wrote about that very nicely in the article.
Yeah, I mean, American troops, and this has been in the U.S. press, the American troops have carried out strikes against forces loyal to the Syrian government several times in 2017. So, I mean, this is an escalation. We've had a war which is a proxy war with the United States backing Islamist forces, which have been waging war against the Syrian army. And now we have U.S. forces waging war or attacking the Syrian army. And on February 7th of this year, the Syrian Arab Army and some allies attempted to recover a critical gas plant near Deir ez-Zor. And they were attacked by the U.S. invaders. But the way it was presented in the U.S. press was that the Syrians provoked or the Syrians threatened the Americans who had to retaliate in self-defense.
Yeah. Well, U.S. I guess the suits, the U.S. diplomats were in danger of being struck by Syrian weaponry in Syria. And if a, I guess an American diplomat is there, that's all you need to know.
Yeah, and the United States says that it has not waging war against the Syrian Arab Army, not waging war against Syria. But, I mean, you could look at it this way. I mean, could Russia invade the United States west of the Colorado River, control the territory's airspace, as the United States does in Syria, plunder its resources, as the United States is doing in northeast Syria, establish new government and administrative structures to supplant the local state and federal authority, and then say, well, we don't seek war with the United States and its armed forces.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was attacked and it retaliated, could it convincingly say, well, we are simply, you know, defending ourselves against the provocation from U.S. armed forces? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is absurd. I mean,
yes.
These are American forces illegally in someone else's country attacking the armed forces of that country, which is operating within its own borders.
Yeah. Now, when you're talking to the U.S., it's like dealing with Captain Kidd or Blackbeard or somebody. It's kind of a pirate's logic. Last question here on this matter is I want to make sure you point out that this is actually a reconquest or recolonization, but there is a little team effort here because this used to be French and British area, but now the U.S. Has assumed the mantle. Is that right? I mean, clearly France and Britain are running interference or doing legwork for the Americans.
Yes, they are. It's a re-imposition of empire. I mean, it's not the French Empire anymore, but it is an empire, the U.S. Empire, with the French and the British now absorbed into the U.S. Empire.
Yeah.
It's certainly contrary to this great wave of decolonization that swept the world in the 20th century, and this appears to be an attempt to reverse that.
Yeah. Well, as if I read your article right, and this is Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, maybe that era of decolonization is going to be resumed. Stephen, we're very grateful. It's a good, very good article, and we look forward to that book on Korea and seeing you visit Toronto.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye. Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And in the moments or two here, this is we don't have any announcements today, do we, Phil?
Just that tomorrow night in Hamilton at 7:30 at the New Vision United Church, the Stop the War group in Hamilton will be having a talk by Chris Black and tell me the professor's name again, Kutturfi.
Kibursi.
Kibursi.
Professor Kibursi, friend of the show.
Yes. We'll be talking about Korea and the danger being posed to world peace by American adventurism in Korea.
Yeah. Very appropriate. By the way, some people say, why talk about it now? There's going to be a meeting. Yeah, there could be a meeting. Yeah. Cross your fingers or maybe put your fingers in your ear. Who knows? We're actually in a very dangerous situation on the Korea thing. When they talk about talking and they're well-armed and they hate each other, you got to be careful that that's when it's kind of like they say, the two most dangerous times on a flight is takeoff and landing. And they claim we're in a landing phase. So everybody tighten your seatbelts and assume the appropriate position should we give you the signal. I want to just say, I congratulate the Syrian army. They have a right to defend themselves. Everybody's always talking about, so-and-so has a right to defend. Syria had a right to defend itself. And did they have a domestic uprising? I don't know, but I know that the United States and France and Britain have no business there. And Saudi Arabia has no business providing weapons to people.
Phil, can I tell you about something that I noticed on a YouTube transmission that came from Syria? President Assad of the Syrian Arab Republic visited East Ghouta, where the fighting has not finished, and he was walking among the people, and I noticed he doesn't have any bodyguards. It's him, and he's meeting the soldiers, right?
Yeah.
And I thought, can you just see Trump or Mrs. May walking in a crowd like that with no bodyguards?
Yeah. Well, I saw the – incidentally, I'm glad you raised that point. Go to Sana, S-A-N-A, and you can see some of the footage. I would – disagree slightly. I saw some bodyguards. So yeah. Maybe you and I went to different schools.
The kind of thing you'd have surrounding this Trump.
Right? One thing is clear.
Yeah.
He has the respect of his soldiers. He has the respect of the population because he's an Arab leader who stood up to a Western power that tried to dictate. And you don't have to be a political scientist to understand that when a great power threatens a smaller nation, the people will rally to their country. They love their country. Americans love to talk about we're number one and we love ourselves and we really outlove ourselves and we're, all this stuff. Well, other people love their countries. Other people have self-respect. Does it ever occur to them? Self-respect of a nation? And they know that the Saudis armed these maniacs. And we've all seen them. They do cut off people's heads. They say, Alawi to death and the Christians to the coast. And I mean, this is a sectarian army financed and armed by the Saudis and the U.S. and France and everybody else. So good for the Syrians. They proved sufficiently cohesive as an ancient nation and know themselves as Syrians. Nobody invented them. And it wasn't the British who drew a line and said, these are Syrians. They know they're Syrians. And they defeated these guys, or are defeating them. It's not over, as Stephen Gowans and others point out. It's definitely not over. However, our hearts should go out to them, and we should be ashamed that the Canadian government and others participated in trying to violate the sovereignty of the Syrian state. Anyhow, this has been the Taylor Report, and I want to thank Braden and Phil, who's Wednesdays, 6 to 8 p.m. And we'll see you next week.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jeffrey Kay, a retired clinical psychologist and independent journalist who examines President Trump's nomination of Gina Haspel to lead the CIA. Despite her history of overseeing the torture of U.S.-held prisoners and destroying evidence, Alexis Rodriguez of the National Puerto Rican Agenda, who talks about Puerto Rico's economic, energy, agricultural, and other crises, which plagued the island before Hurricane Maria struck last year. And independent journalist Eric Blanc, who discusses West Virginia's teacher strike and the significance of their successful wildcat job action for the broader U.S. labor movement. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On a rare visit to the Gaza Strip, Palestinian Prime Minister Rami Hamdallah's convoy was the target of a bomb attack near a border post with Israel. The Prime Minister, who was not injured, was on his way to the opening of a new sewage treatment plant funded by the World Bank and European nations. The roadside bombing triggered a new round of hostility between the Palestinian Authority and the Islamist Hamas movement, which has been in control of Gaza since 2007. The bombing occurred as the Trump administration was hosting a stakeholders meeting in Washington, D.C. to address the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The Palestinian Authority, based in the West Bank, boycotted the meeting. For years, Israel and Egypt have limited access through Gaza's border crossings and effectively isolated the territory's 2 million people. Charitable organizations say that more than 1,000 Palestinians have died in Gaza due to the blockade, which has caused the collapse of the healthcare system with critical shortages of medicines and medical supplies. In recent months, the Trump administration has cut an estimated $300 million to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, or UNRWA, which provides funding for schools and aid to 5 million Palestinians in the occupied territories, Jordan and Lebanon. Yet, the UN agency was not invited to the White House stakeholder gathering. Instead, UNRWA and its supporters held a donor conference in Rome, which raised $100 million, substantially less than what is needed to continue relief programs that aid Palestinians. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte is pulling his Southeast Asian nation out of the International Criminal Court, which investigates human rights violations and war crimes. In early February, the ICC initiated a preliminary inquiry into Duterte's war on drug dealers, which has led to the deaths of 12,000 Filipinos, many who were killed during police raids or targeted by paramilitary groups. Duterte, who many view as Asia's Donald Trump, complained of baseless, unprecedented, and outrageous attacks by United Nations officials, including a call for the Philippines president to undergo a psychiatric examination. Human Rights Watch's Paramprit Singh declared, Duterte has long shown a disdain for the rule of law. Specifically, the Philippines leader promised to pardon and promote police officers who carried out illegal killings. If the ICC concludes that crimes against humanity were committed by the Philippines government, leaving the ICC would not protect Duterte from prosecution. The Rome Treaty, which established the ICC, mandates that national governments must cooperate with criminal investigations, even if they withdraw from the treaty. Former NAACP President Ben Jealous is bringing a progressive agenda to the election for Maryland governor this November. A lifelong civil rights activist and ally of Bernie Sanders, Jealous is calling for free tuition at public universities, Medicare for all, and moving to a $15 an hour minimum wage. Jealous faces a crowded field in the June 26th Democratic primary. His biggest task is to raise his profile in a race without a clear frontrunner. The primary winner will face off against Republican incumbent Governor Larry Hogan. The former NAACP president has worked to improve ties with established Democrats by naming former Maryland State Party Chair Susan Turnbull, a Hillary Clinton supporter, as his running mate. Jealous first got involved in electoral politics as a teenage volunteer in Jesse Jackson's 1988 Rainbow Coalition campaign for president. The experience shaped Jealous in his work at the NAACP, where he broadened the group's agenda to confront stop-and-frisk policing, embraced the DREAM Act for young immigrants, and supported LGBTQ rights. According to In These Times magazine, Jealous has won early support from groups including Progressive Maryland and the state chapter of the Working Families Party. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In a series of cabinet shakeups, President Trump recently fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and then tapped current CIA Director Mike Pompeo to take over at the State Department, after which the president nominated CIA Deputy Director Gina Haspel to lead the nation's spy agency. However, Haspel's nomination has triggered a firestorm of controversy. The intelligence veteran took command of the CIA's covert detention facility in Thailand in 2002, where in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks on the U.S., al-Qaeda terrorist suspects were interrogated and tortured. It was at that site that Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded 83 times in a month and suffered other physical and psychological abuse. While Haspel was in command, another prisoner detainee, Abdul Rahim al-Nashiri, was waterboarded multiple times. Further, in 2005, Haspel was involved in the decision to destroy videotape evidence of the brutal interrogations. While the U.S. has signed several international treaties barring torture, both civilian and intelligence agency officials involved in the U.S. torture program have never been held accountable for their crimes. With Mr. Trump's nomination of Gina Haspel, the U.S. Senate will have a new opportunity to debate America's use of torture during upcoming confirmation hearings. Your reporter spoke with Jeffrey Kay, a retired clinical psychologist and independent journalist who has written extensively about torture. Here he examines issues of international law and morality surrounding Haspel's nomination.
We don't know everything about her. Most of this stuff is classified. I know people are asking, senators are asking for a full declassification of documents. Taking my sources from the Senate Select Committee of Intelligence's report on the CIA and the New York Times account, other accounts that have been written, she was, at least for a brief period of time at the end of 2002, in charge of CIA black site prison in Thailand known as Cat's Eye. And this was during the time that one of the prisoners there, Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri, was waterboarded at least three times and tortured in other ways by the CIA. And so she was involved in that we know of. And then secondarily, a few years later, she had been promoted and now was chief of staff to Jose Rodriguez, who was the director of the counterintelligence service for the CIA. And the two of them kind of brainstormed how to destroy. She was a big proponent, reportedly, of destroying the videotapes of the torture of both al-Nashiri and earlier Abu Zubaydah, another early prisoner at the CIA Thailand black site. You know, this, of course, was a destruction of evidence of torture. So she covered up torture, and according to other people, she was quite the proponent of torture as well. John Kiriakou, who was a CIA agent in that part of the world at that time, was involved in the capture of Abu Zubaydah, claims in an article recently that people inside the CIA called her Bloody Gina because of her proclivity for torture. That's who we're dealing with, and that's who Donald Trump has nominated to be the director of the CIA. And the importance of this is we now have somebody who literally is, if the reports are true, in fact, a torturer, to be the head of the CIA.
Summarize for us, if you would, the laws that have been violated by the CIA and the government that ordered the torture or authorized it, George W. Bush's administration. What are the essential things we need to know regarding
the illegality of torture, regardless of the political rhetoric right. on one side or the other.
Right. During the Reagan administration, later Bush administration officials helped in the drafting of an international treaty that went through the United Nations, and that treaty became known as the Convention Against Torture. And the United States is a signatory to that treaty. In other words, the Convention Against Torture is the law of the United States, which is how our Constitution is written. If you know, you sign a treaty, it becomes actually part of your law. And so whether you consider it domestic or international law, there are laws against the use of torture and cruel and inhumane forms of treatment, because the United States is also a signatory to the Geneva Conventions, which also have portions of it about the use of torture, and that, in fact, the United States, even at this very moment, and even under the Obama administration, was in violation of this treaty.
You have said of Gina Haspel's nomination, describing it as a moral depravity. What should Congress do here? What are their responsibilities here in handling this nomination by Donald Trump of a known and documented torturer?
Well, if they want, you know, they've asked for the documentation on Gina Haspel, and I'm all for the release of documents. That's what I'm really all about. And if they can use this nomination to get further release of details of the torture policies that went on in, during the Bush-Cheney administration of the CIA or any other current ones, I'm all for that. That's about all the good I can see coming from this, of course, and of course reject outright her nomination. But that would just be the beginning of what they should be doing, and this Congress is not going to take the further steps that need to be taken, which would be an investigation at least along the size and impact of the old Church Committee and the and a really full-scale investigation of what's gone on in the past 20 years or so in relation to torture in the United States military and the CIA. There's been some investigations. They should release the entire Senate Select Committee report, of which we only got the executive summary. Thousands of pages, I believe, are still to be released, thousands of documents. We want to know the truth, and that's what people should be asking for.
It prompts one more question here. What signal will the Republican-controlled Senate send to the world if they confirm Donald Trump's nomination of Gina Haspel?
If they confirm if they confirm Gina Haspel, the signal to the world is that the United States claims of any of being any kind of moral force in the world are a farce, they're a lie, and they should not be followed, period. That would be it. The United States will have given up any pretense that it stands for anything moral anymore because it's embraced the worst type of torture that there is.
That was Jeffrey Kay, a retired clinical psychologist and independent journalist who has written extensively about torture. Learn more about Gina Haspel's involvement in the U.S. torture program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 24th, a group of Connecticut-based climate activist organizations sponsored a conference titled A Teach-In for a Livable World, Climate Justice Now. Sponsors included the Connecticut chapters of 350.org and the Sierra Club. A number of speakers at the gathering tackled subjects including environmental racism, labor and publicly owned renewable energy, population and development, women's rights, and more. One of the speakers, Alexis Rodriguez, is a representative of the Connecticut Puerto Rican agenda and an advocate of decolonization. He spoke about the economic, energy, agricultural, and other crises that had existed in Puerto Rico before Hurricane Maria struck on September 20th last year. While water and electric power have been restored to most of the island, more than 100,000 homes remain in the dark and suffer frequent power outages. According to Puerto Rico's government, the storm caused an estimated $100 billion in damage, killed dozens of people, and damaged or destroyed nearly 400,000 homes. Over the 6 months since the hurricane, more than 135,000 people have moved from the island to the U.S. mainland. The destruction wrought by the storm greatly exacerbated the many pre-existing problems on the island. In his talk, Rodriguez asserted that the key to solving the island's problems is to take Puerto Rico out from under the control of the United States. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended and recorded his talk and presents the following excerpts.
Puerto Rico has been in a recession for 11 years. That's not a recession. I use that term because that's what economists coin, but really, even an economist should know that 11 years in recession is a depression. Right? Puerto Rico is in an economic depression. And what we've seen, again, even before Hurricane Maria, is that the system, its political and economic system, has expired. It no longer works. This was before Hurricane Maria, and the hurricane just made that more pronounced. The energy infrastructure of Puerto Rico was archaic. The infrastructure has been neglected. When I mean neglected, by, you know, in regards to the maintenance of these power plants, in regards to any sort of investment to upgrade them. And 98% of the energy consumed in Puerto Rico is derived of fossil fuels. 98% is derived of fossil fuels. Let's also keep in mind that the cost of energy to the individual, the household, the consumer, is twice as much as it is, in some cases, three times as much as it is here in the Northeast. This in a place where most people live under the poverty line. To show you how ridiculous a lot of these efforts to privatize Puerto Rico are, In a meeting with potential investors, the governor of Puerto Rico flat out said to the investors that this is a smart investment to privatize Puerto Rico because consumers pay more than the consumers in the United States. So this is a good way for you to get rich. The nerve. We have people who still have no electricity. We have people... the suicide rates in Puerto Rico are damn near doubled since the hurricane. So the nerve to say that really just explains the mindset of the profiteering of the energy system here. This all in a place that has enough sun to meet its energy demand through solar power. The capacity is already there. There has been countless energy studies done in Puerto Rico that show that Puerto Rico can be fully solar powered. And I'm using the word crisis a lot. So there's a lot of crises that we're talking about here when we talk about Puerto Rico. So that's a little bit about the energy crisis. But I want to move on to the agricultural crisis. Puerto Rico is very food insecure. Puerto Rico is very dependent on imports. Before the hurricane, 85% to 90%, depending on what you found, of the food in Puerto Rico that was consumed in Puerto Rico is imported. 90% of the local agriculture was wiped out in the hurricane. So that only increased that dependency. Not only is that issue of lack of food sovereignty, we have a scenario where thousands of acres of agricultural land have been used for cultivation of genetically modified seeds and testing grounds for agrochemical development. Puerto Rico has essentially been used as a laboratory for a variety of experiments really throughout its history. You know, Agent Orange was tested in the rainforest in Puerto Rico before it was used in war. And that's just one example. Almost all of the water systems in Puerto Rico are not up to par to clean water standards. When I talk about a water crisis, it really does relate to other issues here in the United States, like Flint, Michigan. We're talking about the potential of Flint, Michigan happening on an island-wide scale on a place the size of Connecticut. Almost all of these water systems do not meet clean water standards. Some are not even subject to testing. According to the National Resources Defense Council, Puerto Rico has the highest rate of drinking water violations in relation to the United States. This is water. This is a basic need for human life. And this is the reality that we face in Puerto Rico. Continuing on environmental crisis, the majority of the landfills are over capacity, do not meet standards that are already weak. This has created a toxic conditions where the garbage mixes with the rainwater, creates toxic gases like methane that affect the quality of air in communities throughout Puerto Rico. And it's no coincidence that most of these landfills happen to be in some of the poorest communities in Puerto Rico.
That was Alexis Rodriguez, a representative of the Connecticut Puerto Rican Agenda. He spoke at the February 24th teach-in for a livable world in West Hartford, Connecticut. Learn more about the ongoing crisis confronting the people of Puerto Rico by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 22nd, some 20,000 public school teachers and 13,000 school service employees launched a wildcat strike across the state of West Virginia. The teachers and their supporters were reacting to the state's proposed 1% pay hike for the years 2020 and 21, which they maintained wouldn't cover cost of living increases and a steep rise in health insurance costs. According to the National Education Association, the average salary for West Virginia teachers was ranked 48th in the country in 2016. Although a strike by public employees in West Virginia is illegal, teachers and service employees put everything on the line and struck anyway. The strike affected more than 250,000 students and closed all schools across the state for more than a week. But after 9 days, in disagreement between the State House and Senate on ways to settle the strike, the teachers' union emerged victorious, winning a 5% pay raise for all state workers, a temporary freeze on health insurance premiums, and a pledge to create a task force to address public employees' concern about rising health insurance costs. Your reporter spoke with independent journalist Eric Blanc, who covered the West Virginia teacher strike for Jacobin magazine. Here he discusses the union's success and the significance of their wildcat strike for the broader U.S. labor movement.
In West Virginia, like in most of the United States, public education and teachers and their unions have been under attack for years, decades. So you can look at this as straw that broke the camel's back. The attacks aren't new. What happened really this time was that the proposed changes, the proposed cuts to the health insurance plan, really the proposed mechanisms through which the health insurance in particular would affect teachers. Mainly the premiums would go up dramatically, and there would be a new program called Go365, which would be an incredibly invasive monitoring of teachers' health, in which if they didn't meet certain criteria or improve on certain metrics, their health costs would actually go up based on wearing a Fitbit-type tracking device. And so it was really these two issues in particular, when they were announced in November of last year, enraged really a layer of teachers in West Virginia that already were, as many people know, ranked 48th in the country in pay, who are already, you know, really on the edge of survival. In the interviews I did with a lot of different teachers, these questions of paying a few hundred more dollars in health insurance would be the difference between being able to continue teaching or maybe having to move out of state. So when these proposed governmental reforms to the health insurance came out, there was a lot of anger, and really that snowballed over the course of the last few months and culminated in what we saw in the strike.
Eric, you've called this West Virginia teacher strike one of the most important labor victories since the early 1970s. What was unique about this strike that has you categorize it as such a critically important labor action?
Right. You know, unfortunately, there aren't too many victories since that time that we can choose from. There's not a huge number of labor strikes that have won, or labor strikes, period. But what made this different, I think you could point to three factors. The first was that it was illegal. And I think that shouldn't be underestimated. Even though the superintendents eventually came on board, the risks taken were incredibly high, particularly at first when nobody knew what the repercussions would be. And I think that that fact alone is critically important, because so much of the labor movement throughout the United States for the last decades has been hampered by a legal system and a collective bargaining system that sets the union movement up to fail. And so much of the attempts to revive the labor movement have been more or less failures, or limited at best, because they've attempted to work within the parameters of the law as such. And I think that insofar as West Virginia ignored that and showed that you can have a successful strike despite laws saying that you can't, and despite laws saying that you can't take that form of action, it really points a new way forward, I think, for labor generally in the United States. You can take that as a model. A second point that made it different and really historic was that it was a wildcat strike. It became a wildcat strike. And so for listeners who don't know, that means it's a strike that's not doesn't have the formal approval of the union leadership. And that, again, is not something that we see very often. We haven't seen that since the, you know, in a widespread statewide level since at least in the early 1970s. So on the fourth day of the strike, a deal was reached between the union leadership and the governor. It was announced that the strike was over, and the membership was told, you're going back to work on Thursday. The next day, on Wednesday, school after school on the Facebook group that people organized decided, no, we're not going back. We can't trust the governor. These are just promises. And it turned out that the wildcat really saved the day, because if they had gone back, the momentum would have been lost and the strike could have been lost. And then I think that the third and most exciting, in some ways defining, feature of the strike that makes it different than so many other labor struggles, successful or not, is that it seems to be spreading across the country. I'm not sure how much everybody's been following, but there's major pushes towards similar strike actions in Oklahoma, in Arizona, Kentucky, New Jersey. And so what you see is it appears to have sparked a nationwide public education movement, and that a strike wave in public sector and public education is not something we've seen. And the extent to which that catches on remains to be seen, and it very much depends on what people do in the coming weeks and months to make that potential for a strike wave a reality.
That was independent journalist Eric Blanc, who covered the West Virginia teacher strike for Jacobin Magazine. Learn more about the strike and its potential impact on the U.S. labor movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KMEC in Ukiah, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Behind the stage of the Trump Show. Most news reports and commentaries on the Trump White House are delivered with an air of levity and condescension. Trump is projected as a bumbler, an uninformed jokester who isn't to be taken seriously. At best, reports on Trump's exploits and tweets are given to the public as a kind of comic relief. People laugh, throw up their hands, and move on. Except, this ain't a joke. Most daily newspapers have comics in them, yet they also have serious news coverage. Trump and the forces he has unleashed are nothing to laugh about. Consider what goes virtually unreported during this time of levity and mirth. Trump has installed more U.S. judges in less time than most of his predecessors. These efforts will change the courts for generations to come. Moreover, leftist scholars who've examined this government argue that we are witnessing, in the false name of populism, a kind of neo-fascism, which augurs a kind of Trumpian authoritarianism that is downright scary. John Bellamy Foster, an editor at Monthly Review magazine, writes that what mainstream media is calling populism isn't that at all. Foster argues that Trumpism is really a form of neo-fascism, which has elements similar to the European experience of Italian fascism and German Nazism, masquerading as nationalism. Foster cites the work of Italian philosopher Julius Evola, 1898-1974, who gave intellectual weight to the extreme xenophobia, the extreme exaltation of leaders and government corporate collusion that typified Fellini's rise during the 1930s. He also notes how fascists find sub-intellectual support vital to their efforts. Trumpism isn't a joke. It's a form of politics that has a long and disastrous history. Europe, call it by its true name, neo-fascism. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
How credible is the evidence that Russians were responsible for the poisoning of a former double agent living in Great Britain? What revelations came out of a recent British High Court ruling looking into the apparent poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia? Are there factors complicating both the investigation into the Skripal poisoning and the July 2014 shootdown of Flight MH17? Are there geopolitical and other incentives for the U.S. to implicate Russia rather than Kiev in the shooting down of MH17 that go beyond the evidence? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a look at two major international incidents in recent years which are being used to implicate Russia in malfeasance and explore whether that evidence is strong enough to justify the further escalation of tensions between Russia and the West. We'll first hear from Moscow-based journalist and author John Helmer about the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and a recent court finding in the matter. Then, we'll hear from Kees van der Peil about a little-known fact surrounding the shootdown of Flight MH17 in July 2014. On this week's program, two criminal accusations against Russia, probing the Skripal affair and Flight MH17. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 23rd, 2018. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Apparently, the U.S. has to remain in Syria out of necessity. It cannot afford to sit on the sidelines as Russia reemerges as the major power broker in the region, eating up all the major contracts coming out of Syria, together with Iran, as it looks to poach American allies left, right, and center. Additionally, Russia recently warned the U.S. that it will not tolerate Washington's aggressive attacks on the Syrian government and will respond with strikes of their own should the U.S. military threaten Russian personnel. One should expect that eventually there will be a point where Russia will no longer allow these attacks to go unanswered. As America's power and influence wane, the time will come for both Russia and China to make their mark on the global stage. That comes from the article, Pentagon Officials Searching for a Big War Against Russia and China. A world war might sound crazy, but it could be America's last act of desperation, by Darius Shatamasebi. Posted March 22nd, originally appearing at The Anti-Media. To no avail, since 2008, both Presidents Obama and Trump have followed in the footsteps of George W. Bush. Together with America's NATO allies, they have not only supported terrorist organizations, they have covertly supported terrorist insurgencies, waged an extensive bombing campaign against Libya in 2011, Syria, Yemen, and Iraq 2014, drone attacks and targeted assassinations against Pakistan in 2004, among other military intelligence operations. Under the Kuala Lumpur Initiative to Criminalize War, which was adopted under the helm of Tun Mahathir, all national leaders who initiate aggression must be subjected to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. Let us be crystal clear. Consistent with Nuremberg, the above statement applies to President Donald Trump and the heads of state and heads of government of NATO countries, which endorsed the extensive carpet bombing operations directed against Libya, Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, resulting in the death of countless civilians. That comes from the article, The Ultimate War Crime, America's Global War on Terrorism, The Criminalization of War is the Avenue to Reaching World Peace, by Professor Michel Chossudovsky, posted March 22nd. None of the allegations against Assad and the Syrian government withstand the scrutiny of independent investigations. None. NATO imperialists create atrocity stories to demonize target leaders and to target prey countries with a view to fabricating consent to commit the supreme international crime of war of aggression. They've been fabricating consent and committing war crimes for the past 7 years in Syria. We are accomplices in these crimes when we do not denounce our criminal governments. That comes from the article, Syrians Have Names and Faces, by Mark Taliano, posted March 21st. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. British Prime Minister Theresa May has maintained that the only plausible explanation for the poisoning of a former Russian double agent, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter is that the Russians were responsible. Further, she referred to a nerve agent she claimed was of a type developed in Russia. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has said that London has failed to provide the evidence implicating Russian responsibility for carrying out an attempted murder, and has recently claimed that May's tough stance is pushing Britain and Russia to the brink of war. Does it make sense to take the Prime Minister at her word, or are there other factors in the case that should shake the public's confidence in this narrative? To address the question, the Global Research NewsHour reached out to John Helmer. He's a former political scientist and the longest continuously serving foreign correspondent in Russia. An author and journalist, he is composed a number of articles on the poisoning of the Skripals. He joined us recently by Skype to share his thoughts. Well, first of all, the OPCW had verified that all the chemical agents in Russia had been eliminated. And secondly, I don't think the lab was even in Russia. It was in Uzbekistan, was it not?
Yes, I think that's relatively underimportant in the sense that even if it was located in Uzbekistan, it was under Soviet command. The Russian scientists who've emerged from the woodwork, now all retired, who've spoken about the nerve agents that they produced there. Two of them remain in Russia. One of them went to the United States to make a living there. They all are Russian. They're not Uzbekis. More to the point, they all point out it was the U.S. which dismantled the Uzbek chemical warfare plant. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe there's much doubt that lots of countries have the capability to produce the so-called Novichok or newcomer series, of which there are many iterations and variations. And some of the variations, as described by one of the Russian chemical warfare experts, was a type that could be disseminated by powder form or liquid form, but was not a binary weapon, was not composed of relatively harmless components, which would then be mixed into a lethal combination. So there's a lot of controversy. There's a lot of difference of scientific opinion. And there's no way one can speculate credibly about what happened. Therefore, what the British government has done, since they're not exactly fools, is to have speculated for their domestic political advantage. And that's Mrs. May's political advantage to keep the Tories ahead of the Labour Party. They were not before this affair. To lift her approval rating in relation to Mr. Corbyn, the Labour leader, who was well ahead until this affair. And for Mrs. May to defeat prime ministerial challengers like Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary, and Philip Hammond, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, both of whom have made the case to the other Tories in Parliament that Mrs. May isn't tough enough. So it's best to see this affair in the great words of Tip O'Neill of Massachusetts, all politics is local, so the you have to understand, I believe, that Mrs. May is playing to the domestic constituency and probably gaining as a result. Will she bring the rest of the world closer to war with Russia? Well, she doesn't care.
Hmm. I found the story reminded me of the Iraq weapons of mass destruction claims that they managed, like where they, as the saying goes, they sort of built the evidence or shaped the evidence around the policy.
Yes.
Now you're pointing there to domestic politics. Do you not see a motive a possible motive might also be some sort of alliance with Washington, who is very motivated apparently in provoking more enmity in the public eyes against President Putin?
Well, we can speculate about that. Clearly,
it's a reasonable motive, though.
Has a slightly different opinion at least some time in the day when he congratulated Putin on the electoral win and then failed to follow the script that some of his advisors had written out on cards for him, either because he failed to read or because he disagreed or because he had some other idea in his head at that moment. So, unprecedented event, White House staff leaked their briefing cards for the president. That's never happened before. That's never happened in any administration I've ever worked with or followed in my lifetime. So the Americans are a pile of contradictions themselves. The appointment of John Bolton, a rabid warmonger, as National Security Advisor is another example of the disarray in which the United States government currently is in relation to Russia, to China, and to North Korea, and to Syria. They're the principal enemies and the principal fronts in which the U.S. hawks wish to operate. I left out Iran. I mean, you can imagine five different wars, and that'll just about destroy the rest of the world if they go in the direction that some of them want to go in. But how can we gauge which way they'll go in? It's difficult to say. And in my line of work, I try to stick to
What's
provable and what is proved not to have happened. Speculate as to why the Skripals were poisoned, who benefits, who gains, who did it. I can't do that, Michael. It's too early, and I'm not sure that we'll ever know. After all, it's 4 years now since the shootdown of Malaysian Airlines MH17 over the Ukraine, and we still don't really know how it was done, why it was done, or by whom it was done.
John Helmer explained that he does not think Sergei Skripal was a particularly significant intelligence asset for the British side.
When he was betraying the Russian side for the British, his work involved handing over a telephone directory for GRU, some information about one of the Russian space cosmodromes in Kazakhstan, stuff that was pretty low level. You can be sure that it was low level because his prison sentence was very short by spy standards, by American or Russian or British espionage standards. He wasn't shot. He got, I believe, 13 years, and he was exchanged after 4 or 5 or 6, I can't recall which. So his real value to the British and to the Russians when he was an active double agent was small. And from all accounts, he received about $100,000 worth over several years. In other words, about $20,000 a year. That's paltry. That's peanuts. So I think from the hints that GRU has given not to influence public opinion against Skripal, the conclusion is he was a relatively minor creature playing a very minor role for a very small sum of money, for a very small jail sentence, who was exchanged for people of much greater value to the Russian side. Then he disappears into England, and unlike some of his other colleagues, he has no exposure to the press. He doesn't write an autobiography. He doesn't do anything to make a name for himself. And the rest, you and the listeners can all do exactly what I've done, read the British press. Apparently, he continued to meet some of his colleagues, Russian colleagues, ex or retired group men. Apparently, he continued to meet with some of his MI6 and other British intelligence colleagues. Apparently, he was in business with some of them. And he was seriously ill with diabetes. He had medical problems. He had money problems. You can check from the quality of his house that he lived modestly. So what does one learn about this fellow? That he was of very minor importance. That has led to all sorts of speculation, particularly broadcasting on the Russian side, that it's a vulgar and unpleasant thing to say. And unpersuasive, that it wasn't worth a state effort to assassinate him. I don't think that proves anything either way. It's a vulgar and an unnecessary thing to say. The issue here is whether the evidence, both the nerve agent evidence, the blood sampling evidence, and other evidence indicates an official or professional assassination attempt. And if it does, who? You can have a variety of theories. My sources have theories. And you might discuss theories over a beer, but not on a serious radio program like yours, Michael.
Appreciate that. You forwarded to me a recently posted article, the headline, "The Skripal Case Goes to Court for the First Time, New Uncertainties for the British and Russian Governments." And it talks about how British High Court Justice David Williams issued the first court adjudication.
Yeah.
Thank you. Of evidence presented by the British government of what happened to Sergei Skripal and his daughter in Salisbury on the 4th of March. Maybe just give us kind of a quick synopsis of that article and why it's so important.
It's very important because this is the first time the case went to a court. Now, since March the 4th, allegations have been made about what happened and who did it. The evidence is not being presented, but in this particular court case, it's a special court, the Court of Protection, part of the High Court's family division. That's the division of the court that takes care of vulnerable people, persecuted people, incapacitated people, mentally ill people, people who can't readily instruct lawyers to act for them, who may not understand or may be too ill to act in their own best interests. So the court has to act in the best interests of the applicant. In this particular case, the British government, through the Home Office, the Salisbury National Health Trust, the hospital, and a barrister and solicitor appointed to represent the Skripals applied to the judge to authorize the fresh blood sampling and the disclosure of medical records. They would normally be things that a normal person in full capacity and would give his or her consent to, right? In this particular case, this court case, which was heard behind closed doors earlier this week in London, went and tried to create the legal structure so that the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, which is in the Netherlands, can come across to Britain and make their own investigation according to the Convention on Chemical Weapons, which Russia and Britain endorse. Now, the Russian side has insisted on this from the beginning. Mrs. May, Mr. Johnson, the British cabinet, have tried an end run around it. Now, facing general condemnation, if not stated obviously and explicitly by the Europeans, but general condemnation that they rushed to judgment, the British are saying, we're going to comply with the OPCW procedures and according to the treaty which we signed, and we will comply with what the Russians ask by having an independent OPCW investigation. To make that independent, the OPCW has to take blood samples. Blood samples of the two Skripals in order to establish what nerve agent may have been used, in order then to match those samples with any chemical warfare traces or identifiers that Porton Down Laboratory, the British Chemical Weapons Laboratory, has kept records of and samples of and so on. Second, the blood samples will be used to generate a DNA match to see if the blood sampling that's done by OPCW matches the blood sampling that the British did at the beginning of the investigation. The British sampling would not be admissible in court because there's no secure chain of custody of the evidence to prevent tampering. And the Russian side made it very clear in a statement issued by the Foreign Ministry in Moscow on March 21. So the court case has been, in a sense, an answer to Russian demands for the British to behave legally. The puzzle about it, about the court case and the judgment, is that it reveals that the Russians didn't know and weren't allowed into the court case to represent the Skripals. Now, the Russian side has been saying, look, Yulia Skripal is a Russian citizen. She's been attacked. She's close to death in a hospital, and we demand under the consular and international conventions access to her to see what her condition is and represent her as a Russian citizen with Russian family and roots. The Russian side says they've been denied all this access. The British court confirms no access. Indeed, the lawyer for the Skripals, allegedly independent, says that no practical or appropriate reference has been made to anyone in Russia, family members of the Skripals, relatives of the Skripals, anyone, as if the Russian state hasn't been attempting to make contact. So that you have this closed-door hearing, which provides new evidence, which I'll come to in a minute, but keeps the Russians out in order to allow the OPCW to take samples to investigate, just as the Russian side has demanded. It's very peculiar. It's very unusual. But since it's the first court case, it tells you something about the quality of British justice here. And here we come to a second major discovery in the judgment. Now, bear in mind, this was a closed-door hearing over 3 days. There were two witnesses from Porton Down, the chemical warfare specialists. There was the clinician, the doctor, attending the Skripals to describe their condition and what the medical records show. All this was kept behind closed doors. Russian intelligence agents, who hadn't been booted out by Mrs. May during this week, apparently didn't know this court case was even going on, because the Russian side didn't protest that they should have been represented. They didn't provide any lawyers themselves, which is another question. Still, there were five witnesses, including a Home Office and Foreign Office, Porton Down in the hospital. The judge decided that he would give a private judgment, closed doors judgment, but then would issue a public version. And that's the version you can read on my website today. It was issued yesterday in London. Some of the British papers have picked it up. Like all the rest of the British press, they can't read the document for what it tells you. And listeners might struggle to understand its significance. But all you have to do is persist with a bottle of beer at the small print, and then you discover these remarkable things. First of all, the summary the judge gives of the Porton Down evidence is that a nerve agent of the Novichok class or closely related to it was found in trace in the blood samples of the Skripals. Now, that doesn't say Russia. It doesn't say manufactured in Russia. It doesn't say Russian origin at all. In fact, it's a very loose description of what caused the attack.
Okay.
It doesn't identify source. That's very important. That doesn't mean that Prime Minister May's been lying or that Foreign Secretary Johnson's been lying. They've been exaggerating. Mm-hmm. That's true. But they've been referring to evidence beyond the chemical evidence. So in one of the stories I've reported, I've urged people to look for what other types of evidence might there be for the British to be so convinced there was an official Russian assassination operation. And that includes electronic monitoring, which you can pick up, at least retrospectively. You can tell how much mobile telephone traffic there was in the center of Salisbury around the Skripals from, let's say, 1 o'clock in the afternoon till 4:15 when they were discovered on the bench. You can tell whether the electronic traffic was encrypted. That increases the likelihood. You've got sophisticated people communicating in a special way. If there's nothing like that, then you know there wasn't an official assassination attempt. What you can be sure of, not to get everybody's conspiratorial instincts and whiskers twitching here, what you can be sure of is that the British are not going to announce publicly all of the types of evidence they've got, especially if they haven't got any. So this is a court case, the very first, which shows a glimpse into what Porton Down knows. Well, it's not a convincing case about Russian origin at all. It also opens the window to mistakes, ignorance, and possibly negligence on the Russian side in failing to provide lawyers for Yulia Skripal. The hospital, for example, told the court nobody connected to the Skripals had made any contact since they fell ill. Well, I rang the hospital to ask how they were. But I don't qualify because I'm a reporter. Did any member of the Skripal family in Russia make contact? Did they make contact through the government? Did the government consider having lawyers, British lawyers, go into court and apply for habeas corpus, a traditional British method for producing evidence relating to a person who's being detained against their will? Being sick in a hospital is being detained. You can have habeas corpus in court. You oblige the authorities, whoever it is, in this case the hospital and the Home Office and the police, to explain why and how and so forth. All of this stuff, the Russian government could have done a lot better at managing than they have. Mm. They have fallen for the British propaganda war, and I'm trying to bring us back to some basis on which the two powerful governments in the world are at serious odds with one another over what's happened to these two unfortunate individuals.
We just spoke with Moscow-based author and journalist John Helmer. An archive of his articles can be found at the website johnhelmer.net. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. On July 17, 2014, an aircraft Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was shot down over eastern Ukraine airspace, killing 283 passengers and 15 crew on board. The Dutch Safety Board released its final report on the incident in October of 2015, saying a surface-to-air Buk missile was responsible. In September 2016, the Joint Investigation Team released its findings that a Buk missile was indeed responsible and that it had been fired from rebel territory, and that the system which fired the missile had been transported from Russia the day of the crash. Case Vanderpyle released a book recently, the English version of which is entitled Flight MH17 and the New Cold War. Case Vanderpyle is a professor emeritus of international relations at the University of Sussex and former director of the Center for Global Political Economy. He's currently active with the Dutch anti-fascist resistance, having served as its president. In September of 2017, he was in Winnipeg, and the Global Research News Hour had an opportunity to interview him about the book.
I would say, without overstating my case, that you might dismiss both official reports, so the final report of the Dutch Safety Board, which had taken on the investigation of the technical aspects on behalf of both Ukraine and the Netherlands, and the last report, there will be more, but the last report of the Joint Investigation Team, which is a larger group of countries involved in the whole process, you might dismiss them as completely... Well, not completely irrelevant, because in what they leave out, what they don't mention, and where they fail, and where they actually misrepresent the situation on the basis of known facts, they are highly meaningful, of course. It's very important to see what they, for one reason or another, may even be coincidence, what they don't mention, of course, is and misrepresent, is in itself important. That cannot be entirely without a reason.
Suggesting guilty demeanor.
Yeah, I would say, well, the one factor that completely undermines both reports or both streams of reporting is the role of the veto that has been granted to the Kiev regime that came to power in a coup in February 2014. And the fact that the rulers in Kiev may forbid certain facts to come out, and that, you know, you can actually detail at which moment and under which circumstances these vetoes were granted, makes clear that obviously they are a party of something very important to hide, because otherwise you wouldn't demand such a stringent restriction on the pursuit of the investigation.
This sounds similar to the 9/11 commission, in which the director, Philip Zelikow, had the ability to vet the information going into it.
I guess so. And there are many similarities, although I wouldn't simply compare the two, because, of course, in the series of blogs that I write on this and for our anti-war site in Holland, is called Will MH17 Be Our 9/11? But it's still with a question mark, because whereas 9/11 gave us the war on terror, which is basically a war against the world that is spreading every half year, you can't say that the civil war in Ukraine has led to more than a bolstering of the NATO alliance at a very critical moment, because in the autumn of 2014, NATO had a very important upcoming conference, for which everybody expected that the debacle in Afghanistan would be a major bone of contention. And here suddenly they get the gift of being able to paint Putin as the immediate threat to European security and so on. So in that sense, it hasn't led to a major war in Europe, but it has led to an influx of American troops, to all kind of maneuvers and provocations in the Baltic Sea, and especially in the Baltic countries and in Poland, and of course in Ukraine itself, where we're still looking at a slow-burning fuse that might lead to an explosion any time. That is a very uncertain factor.
Could you point to some of the international indicators before the shooting down of the flight that might lead us to believe that this is
there's something suspicious about this flight being shot down.
And mind you that the book is set up in such a way that in the beginning I already say that I don't know who actually pulled the trigger in this case. Even what was the sort of weapon that downed the plane. I don't know these things. But the book is set up by listing all the facts that we can know and that we can see for ourselves, and then slowly getting to the point where you almost can conclude, and sometimes very tempting to say, well, it must have been, as I would say, the Kiev regime with NATO connivance.
Well, it's pretty principle in any investigation to establish who had the motive.
Yeah. Well, as I say, and that's something that's completely ignored by the official investigations. But if you want to sum up briefly, what are the circumstances that make one believe that Kiev plus NATO advisors, at least, was most complicit? Then, of course, you have to look at the expansion of NATO. You have to look at the attempts to bring Ukraine and Georgia into the NATO alliance, which in 2008, of course, led to a reckless military adventure, which is routinely called in the media the Russian invasion, but it was actually a military attempt by Saakashvili of Georgia to recapture dissident provinces. That is one factor. You have to look at the energy equation, in which after Gazprom, the Russian gas monopoly, had established a pipeline under the North Sea, under the Baltic Sea, which is called Nord Stream, that they wanted to expand that by a pipeline under the Black Sea, which was called South Stream, and which would land in Bulgaria. That was a major issue because whereas Nord Stream had not been prevented, the West, at all costs, the United States mainly and Britain, wanted to prevent the creation of South Stream. And the story that which is in the book about how they put pressure under Bulgaria to drop its willingness to receive the pipeline and so on and so forth is in itself very telling about which measures were being taken. Now, in connection with that, you can see that the Western navies were penetrating the Black Sea. Under the treaty provisions, they can remain there if they're not part of the border. If they're not bordering themselves on the Black Sea, they can remain there for 21 days. And the United States was very prominent. And after the coup in February, the coup occurred on the back of popular demonstrations that were authentic protests against the rapaciousness of the Ukrainian oligarchs then in power. Other oligarchs were waiting in the wing and hoping to utilize a popular uprising so that they could take over central power, which is what happened. But after the coup, it was clear that the new government, the coup government of ultra-nationalist Ukrainians, mainly from the west of the country, wanted to end the agreement with Russia to lease the naval port of Sevastopol, which is basically holds the key to naval control, to maritime control of the Black Sea. And if you combine that with the advance of NATO to Ukraine and trying to get Ukraine and Georgia along, you can imagine that it's fully in the line of expectation to see at one point U.S. naval squadrons or NATO naval squadrons entering the port of Sevastopol after the Russians had left. Now that in connection again with South Stream, which already was on the rocks when MH17 happened, gives you a sense that we're also looking at a struggle for military dominance in the Black Sea area, because it's mostly surrounded by NATO states. Turkey was then still entirely in line with the West. So that's one important dimension. The United States is very keen to actually disrupt the supply of Europe, of the EU, with Russian gas. But they are also concerned about the rise of the BRICS countries as a rival bloc against Western austerity. And interestingly enough, in mid-July 2014, Putin was traveling through Latin America and ending up in Brazil, where he met the other leaders of the BRICS countries, and they put their signatures under the charter of a BRICS bank. Not much has come of this BRICS bank, but that wasn't clear at the time. At the time, it looked as if a veritable challenge to IMF, World Bank dominance of world international trade and payment arrangements had been put in place. And the United States were most concerned about that, and were also very concerned about something that happened on the margins of that BRICS bank event, and that was a contact between Putin and Chancellor Merkel, who happened to be also in Brazil for the finals of the World Football Football Championship. And he agreed with her the Land for Gas Agreement. And the Land for Gas Agreement was basically to settle the Ukrainian conflict, to allow to yield control of Crimea to Russia, and in exchange for that to have Russia sign up to a multi-billion rehabilitation program for Ukraine, cheap gas, etc. Many details can still be added. All that happened before July 17, which was the fatal date for the plane. And on 16 July, when Putin was still in Fortaleza in Brazil, the United States issued new sanctions, and key among those sanctions were sanctions targeting the energy sector, targeting the supply of Europe with Russian gas in all kinds of ways. South Stream, as I said, was already on the rocks, etc. Of course, I can't say and I can't prove that they were also very upset about the Merkel-Putin agreement on because that is based on journalistic information, quality stuff, I would say, but not of the same documentary status as the other issue. United States issues these sanctions, calls in all the EU ambassadors at the State Department, and tells them this has to be followed now by the EU because Russia is supplying the rebels and so on and so forth. The EU holds a meeting also on 16 July, and there they can't reach agreement. They give out a declaration, which actually in the course of the day of 17 July became public. And in that declaration is included, as a last paragraph, it's not a long declaration, but as a last paragraph is included, the need to start triangular discussions and negotiations between the EU, Russia, and Ukraine on the security of the gas supply, energy supply.
The United States is in there.
but the United States is not part of that. That's an EU declaration. Later in the day, MH17 is downed. Immediately after that, all kind of things happen, of course. An enormous uproar in the West. Very doubtful claims about who did it. Contradictory claims. That's something that we can leave aside for the moment. And on 22 July... so 5 days after the event, the EU comes with has another meeting at the foreign minister level, and they come with a replica of the U.S. sanctions. So they yield to the American sanctions and endorse them. And interestingly enough, the whole aspect of the energy triangular discussions has been has disappeared and is replaced by a last paragraph which says that the sanctions should in particular target the energy sector, which basically means that the EU tells itself to shut off its own gas supply because it's not so easy to think where the alternative gas would come from. Of course, the United States wants to sell its the gas that it obtains by fracking and that it ships to Europe as liquid natural gas. But that's far more expensive than the gas it receives from through the existing pipelines from Russia. Now, that I think is a very important, because here we are talking about what happened one day before MH17 and what happened a few days after MH17. But what I try to do in the book is to show that it's never You know, complex historical events, and however odd it sounds, even shooting down a plane in the context of a civil war, it's ultimately a complex event because many issues are involved. There was, for instance, also exactly in the area where the plane came down, there was an Ukrainian, a Kiev military detachment was isolated because there had been a military push to try and separate the two rebellious provinces, and that had failed, and there was an isolated detachment which somehow had to be reached. So that is a factor as well. There's also the military situation. There are absurd facts that I have been able to document on the basis of the Dutch government's own documentation in combination with press. The press can still be trusted, but only one day. That is the first day when they report on things that become public before the so-called news image has or the consensus.
Before the narrative is established itself.
Yes, when a reporter simply said, "I heard a bang." And 2 days later, it's better not to report that bang anymore.
Yeah.
But in this case, interestingly, the newspapers also reported on the fact that the Dutch government, you would almost say in a flash of complete madness, planned to dispatch a brigade, or the so-called Rapid Intervention Brigade, to eastern Ukraine to militarily secure the area where the plane had come down on the grounds that it was a plane mostly containing Dutch victims. Now, of course, that would have been a casus belli for Russia, because you can imagine when one of the crack Dutch military units suddenly appears in eastern Ukraine fully armed and landing from the air, etc. Luckily for us and for the world, I guess, this brigade is part of a joint division with Germany, which also provides half of the so-called quick reaction division. And the German commander, I guess, on instructions from his own government, immediately dismissed this operation as complete madness. So it didn't, in the end, happen. But to give you a sense of the risks that we were talking about, the confusion that happens, and also it reminds you of the fact that so many more factors are involved. There's, for instance, the coup itself in February 2014 was already accompanied by a sort of economic coup, in the sense that heavy industry from Ukraine was being exposed to competition and neglect, whereas intensive agriculture with EU and American agribusiness involvement was stepped up. Poroshenko, the current president, a completely corrupt figure, but then the other oligarchs are, of course, also corrupt, is a product also of the shift in the Ukrainian economy from heavy industry, which was mostly in Donetsk, and, Akhmetov was the famous oligarch associated with that block of forces. But Poroshenko represents light industry and the food sector, and he and his entourage of people who are active in poultry industry and in agriculture were looking very much to the EU as a form of reinforcing their economic position. So there's no way in which you can reduce even this single event to one single, let's say, evil figure who had some devilish plan, etc., etc. We're looking at the dramatic unfolding of a coming together of endless streams of different, sometimes interconnected, sometimes unconnected developments. And in the book I even list things that, for instance, all the types of armament that were available, who had bugs, in what state of readiness were they, what sort of plane could have been involved if it were a plane, what was the sort of damage to the plane, etc. Always with the footnote, I don't know who did it, but look at what was available and who had it, and etc. I've read very tempting stories about planes having been upgraded in Israel, flown back to Ukraine and used for the downing, and yet I'm suspicious of that sort of line of argument because I'm not competent to judge, and the basis for it is too thin. But it is really
there are lots of things that are questionable, but some of that you don't want to bring in because it's
No, and you can also use some of the things that probably didn't play a role to discredit the committees that did the investigations. For instance, if you have a security board, the Dutch Safety Board, which does an investigation of the plane, and you can read on the basis of indisputable bills of lading that the plane transported 1.3 tons of lithium-ion batteries, which are highly flammable and potentially explosive. And it was not allowed to transport that amount of lithium-ion batteries on a civilian plane. And the committee, in its final official report, says that it was one battery on the plane, but it was well packaged. Then you realize it may have nothing to do with it. It may even be a slip, although it sounds that's probably over the top. But you don't call 1.3 tons of a very flammable industrial type of battery one little battery, but that was properly packaged. Now, in that sense, there are very many things that have to be mentioned. I even mentioned the fact that Malaysia was a critic of Western austerity policies, so that the fact that we have seen the disappearance of a Malaysian Airlines plane over military sensitive area in the South China Sea and a Malaysian plane over eastern Ukraine, you know, that is an element that you should add to the subtle weights that are all involved in this complex matter, and that remind you of the fact that it may have been that these circumstances may have worked to remove certain inhibitions. That somebody may have said, well, if a plane has to go down, then because there was also an Air India, and I think if I remember correctly, an Air Singapore plane a few minutes away, that Malaysia then is selected, so to speak. But I don't know whether that worked, but it's yeah, I can't say it's nice because it's, of course, a very grim subject. Mind you, that apart from the almost 300 people who perished in this terrible accident, more than 10,000 people in eastern Ukraine had already been killed in the most gruesome ways, with a lot of torture on the side, etc. A million people had been were refugees. 1.5 million were internally displaced. So we're talking about a major humanitarian disaster that would fill all the headlines were it not that these are people that we're not interested in. They are victims that we don't respect because they are victims on the wrong side of the equation from the Western NATO EU standpoint.
I wanted to ask you one more question as we kind of, you know, tie up this conversation. What kind of a critical reception? Because you're a published author.
Okay? Yeah, yeah.
And I'm curious to know what kind of a popular reception you've been getting as a result of this book being released.
I think it will be dealt with by complete silence, because it's almost frightening to think that the mainstream media and the government have entrenched in an untenable position. You know, even if two-thirds of my book is wrong, the official position is completely wrong. It's untenable. There are violations of the laws of physics. There are violations of common sense in endless ways. To backtrack, to suddenly say, well, there's now a book out, and for all its limitations, it comes with an alternative vision, in my view, is impossible. Because that would mean that the government and the mainstream media would have to concede to the larger public that they have been lying. And I made an attempt at an earlier stage to actually send a letter to the editor about when they carried something that was completely out of order. And they replied to me personally with all kind of claims and counterclaims, etc., but without wanting to publish it even on their website, let alone the hard copy. And I think that is a hint of what I can expect. The best Well, the best you can hope is that I will be dismissed as a sort of crank, etc. But that is difficult. I have a long list of publications in very respected sources. This comes out in a major university press in the UK. It has been vetted by top-level reviewers who have made criticism, but who have enthusiastically endorsed the quality of the work. I mean, that's how these presses operate. They hardly read anything anymore themselves, but they farm it out to specialists to look at it and say yes or no. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I'm very happy it comes out there so that they can't dismiss it, because I have always also published with an excellent publisher like Pluto. But Pluto is, of course, a left-wing publisher, and they could then dismiss it and say, well, it's marginal. I said, this is not marginal. This is a big mainstream publisher in the United Kingdom. And so I'm curious, and I look forward to see how it is being received. And you know, as you always hope in these matters, I hope I won't be the only one who comes up with an alternative reading, because I'm sure that I will have made mistakes in the book, that I will have although some bloggers who know every blade of grass in that area have helped me weed out where I became trapped in propaganda stories that I took serious, and so on. But there will still be mistakes, and therefore you hope that we can somehow restore. It has to do something with democracy and openness and transparency, that we can somehow restore a quest for an honest account of what is actually happening in the world around us and which risks are attached to the current course that we're following. Because NATO is really raising the stakes of the confrontation with Russia to an unacceptable degree, and there are far more important things than the border conflicts. For instance, the positioning of anti-missile missiles that can also be exchanged for real attack missiles is a casus belli almost in its own right. It's a very frightening situation. And sometimes I think, you know, I'm not a particular fan of Vladimir Putin, but I think he's a statesman of the caliber of, let's say, a Bismarck, somebody who with a very rational view of things and a moderate. All the Putin bashing that we see in the newspapers with us and on TV, lies and all. You know, at some point, if he would really be succeeded by anyone, it might be a person that we someone that will make extreme, us make us dream back to the days of somebody that you could talk to, and you know, we've seen the interviews with Oliver Stone. Mm-hmm. This is a man who can who's open to all sorts of negotiations, even from my own point of view, to more negotiations than I think is wise for the future of Russia. But that's his business and not mine.
Well, Dr. Vanderpyl, I really appreciate having had this conversation with you. I think I can say with some confidence that certainly independent sites like Global Research and other independent media will give your book respectful attention for all the reasons that you just mentioned.
They already did. Global Research had a piece on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate that very much. Thanks very much, Michael.
Thank you for your time.
Okay.
That was Kees Vanderpyl, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at the University of Sussex and former Director of the Center for Global Political Economy, and also author of the book, Flight MH17, Ukraine and the New Cold War. He spoke to us in Winnipeg in the fall of 2017. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. Our show airs weekly on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We got our podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Bye for now.